The woman told a child to call the deaths in, and he scampered to the door and spoke to them. Will and Lyra watched in wonder, and the Gallivespians drew closer together as the deaths, one for each of the family, came in through the door. Pale, unremarkable figures in shabby clothes, just drab and quiet and dull.
"These are your deaths,"
said Tialis.
"Indeed, sir."
"Do you know when they'll tell you it's time to go?"
"No, but you know they're close by, and that's a comfort."
Tialis said nothing, but it was clear that he felt it would be anything but a comfort. The deaths stood politely along the wall, and it was strange to see how little space they took up and to find how little notice they attracted. Lyra and Will soon found themselves ignoring them altogether, though Will thought, "Those men I killed, their deaths were close beside them all the time. They didn't know, and I didn't know." The woman, Martha, dished the stew onto chipped enamel plates and put some in a bowl for the deaths to pass among themselves. They didn't eat, but the good smell kept them content. Presently all the family and their guests were eating hungrily, and Peter asked the children where they'd come from and what their world was like.
"I'll tell you all about it," said Lyra.
As she said that, as she took charge, part of her felt a little stream of pleasure rising upwards in her breast like the bubbles in champagne. And she knew Will was watching, and she was happy that he could see her doing what she was best at, doing it for him and for all of them. She started by telling about her parents. They were a duke and duchess, very important and wealthy, who had been cheated out of their estate by a political enemy and thrown into prison. But they managed to escape by climbing down a rope with the baby Lyra in her father's arms, and they regained the family fortune, only to be attacked and murdered by outlaws. Lyra would have been killed as well, and roasted and eaten, had not Will rescued her just in time and taken her back to the wolves, in the forest where he was being brought up as one of them. He had fallen overboard as a baby from the side of his father's ship and been washed up on a desolate shore, where a female wolf had suckled him and kept him alive. The people ate up this nonsense with placid credulity, and even the deaths crowded close to listen, perching on the bench or lying on the floor close by, gazing at her with their mild and courteous faces as she spun out the tale of her life with Will in the forest. He and Lyra stayed with the wolves for a while, and then moved to Oxford to work in the kitchens of Jordan College. There they met Roger, and when Jordan was attacked by the brick burners who lived in the clay beds, they had to escape in a hurry. So she and Will and Roger captured an Egyptian narrow boat and sailed it all the way down the Thames, nearly getting caught in Abingdon Lock. And then they'd been sunk by the whopping pirates and had to swim for safety to a three-masted clipper just setting off for Hang Chow in Cathay to trade for tea. And on the clipper they'd met the Gallivespians, who were strangers from the moon, blown down to the earth by a fierce gale out of the Milky Way. They'd taken refuge in the crow's nest, and she and Will and Roger used to take turns going up there to see them. Only one day Roger lost his footing and plunged down into Davy Jones's locker. They tried to persuade the captain to turn the ship around and look for him, but he was a hard, fierce man, only interested in the profit he'd make by getting to Cathay quickly, and he clapped them in irons. But the Gallivespians brought them a file, and so on. From time to time she'd turn to Will or the spies for confirmation, and Salmakia would add a detail or two, or Will would nod, and the story wound itself up to the point where the children and their friends from the moon had to find their way to the land of the dead in order to learn, from her parents, the secret of where the family fortune had been buried.
"And if we knew our deaths in our land, like you do here, it would be easier, probably. But I think we're really lucky to find our way here, so's we could get your advice. And thank you very much for being so kind and listening, and for giving us this meal. It was really nice. But what we need now, you see, or in the morning maybe, is we need to find a way out across the water, where the dead people go, and see if we can get there too. Is there any boats we could sort of hire?"
They looked doubtful. The children, flushed with tiredness, looked with sleepy eyes from one grown-up to the other, but no one could suggest where they could find a boat. Then came a voice that hadn't spoken before. From the depths of the bedclothes in the corner came a dry, cracked, nasal tone. Not a woman's voice, not a living voice. It was the voice of the grandmother's death.
"The only way you'll cross the lake and go to the land of the dead,"
he said, and he was leaning up on his elbow, pointing with a skinny finger at Lyra,
"is with your own deaths. You must call up your own deaths. I have heard of people like you, who keep their deaths at bay. You don't like them, and out of courtesy they stay out of sight. But they're not far off. Whenever you turn your head, your deaths dodge behind you. Wherever you look, they hide. They can hide in a teacup, or in a dewdrop, or in a breath of wind. Not like me and old Magda here,
he said, and he pinched her withered cheek, and she pushed his hand away.
We live together in kindness and friendship. That's the answer. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Say welcome. Make friends. Be kind. Invite your deaths to come close to you and see what you can get them to agree to.
His words fell into Lyra's mind like heavy stones, and Will, too, felt the deadly weight of them.
How should we do that?
You've only got to wish for it, and the thing is done.
Wait,
said Tialis. Every eye turned to him, and those deaths lying on the floor sat up to turn their blank, mild faces to his tiny, passionate one. He was standing close by Salmakia, his hand on her shoulder. Lyra could see what he was thinking. He was going to say that this had gone too far. They must turn back. They were taking this foolishness to irresponsible lengths. So she stepped in.
Excuse me,
she said to the man, Peter.
But me and our friend the Chevalier, we've got to go outside for a minute, because he needs to talk to his friends in the moon through my special instrument. We won't be long.
And she picked him up carefully, avoiding his spurs, and took him outside into the dark, where a loose piece of corrugated iron roofing was banging in the cold wind with a melancholy sound.
You must stop,
he said, as she set him on an upturned oil drum, in the feeble light of one of those anbaric bulbs that swung on its cable overhead.
This is far enough. No more.
But we made an agreement.
No, no, not to these lengths.
All right, leave us. You fly on back. Will can cut a window into your world or any world you like, and you can fly through and be safe. That's all right. We don't mind.
Do you realize what you're doing?
Yes.
You don't. You're a thoughtless, irresponsible, lying child. Fantasy comes so easily to you that your whole nature is riddled with dishonesty. And you don't even admit the truth when it stares you in the face. Well, if you can't see it, I'll tell you plainly. You cannot, you must not risk your death. You must come back with us now. I'll call Lord Asriel, and we can be safe in the fortress in hours.
Lyra felt a great sob of rage building up in her chest and stamped her foot, unable to keep still.
You don't know. You just don't know what I got in my head or my heart, do you? I don't know if you people ever have children. Maybe you lay eggs or something. I wouldn't be surprised. Because you're not kind, you're not generous, you're not considerate. You're not cruel, even. That would be better, if you were cruel. Because it'd mean you took us serious. You didn't just go along with us when it suited you. Oh, I can't trust you at all now. You said you'd help, and we'd do it together. And now you want to stop us. You're the dishonest one, Tialis.
I wouldn't let a child of my own speak to me in the insolent, high-handed way you're speaking, Lyra. Why, I haven't punished you before.
Then go ahead. Punish me since you can. Take your bloody spurs and dig them in hard. Go on. Here's my hand. Do it. You've got no idea what's in my heart, you proud, selfish creature. You've got no notion how I feel sad and wicked and sorry about my friend Roger. You kill people just like that.
She snapped her finger.
They don't matter to you. But it's a torment and a sorrow to me that I never said goodbye to him. And I want to say sorry and make it as good as I can. You'd never understand that, for all your pride, for all your grown-up cleverness. And if I have to die to do what's proper, then I will, and be happy while I do. I've seen worse than that. So if you want to kill me, you hard man, you strong man, you poison-bearer, you chevalier, you do it. Go on, kill me. Then me and Roger can play in the land of the dead forever and laugh at you, you pitiful thing.
What Tialis might have done then wasn't hard to see, for he was ablaze from head to foot with a passionate anger, shaking with it. But he didn't have time to move before a voice spoke behind Lyra, and they both felt a chill fall over them. Lyra turned around, knowing what she'd see and dreading it despite her bravado. The Death stood very close, smiling kindly, his face exactly like those of all the others she'd seen. But this was hers, her very own Death. And Pantalaimon at her breast howled and shivered, and his ermine shape flowed up around her neck and tried to push her away from the Death. But by doing that, he only pushed himself closer, and realizing it, he shrank back towards her again, to her warm throat and the strong pulse of her heart. Lyra clutched him to her and faced the Death directly. She couldn't remember what he'd said, and out of the corner of her eye, she could see Tialis quickly preparing the lodestone resonator, busy.
"You're my Death, ain't you?"
"Yes, my dear."
"You ain't gonna take me yet, are you?"
"You wanted me. I am always here."
"Yes, but I did, yes. But I want to go to the land of the dead, that's true. But not to die. I don't want to die. I love being alive. And I love my demon, and demons don't go down there, do they? I seen them vanish and just go out like candles when people die. Do they have demons in the land of the dead?"
"No. Your demon vanishes into the air, and you vanish under the ground."
"Then I want to take my demon with me when I go to the land of the dead. And I want to come back again. Has it ever been known for people to do that?"
"Not for many, many ages. Eventually, child, you will come to the land of the dead with no effort, no risk, a safe, calm journey in the company of your own Death, your special, devoted friend, who's been beside you every moment of your life, who knows you better than yourself."
"But Pantalaimon is my special and devoted friend. I don't know you, Death. I know Pan, and I love Pan. And if he ever... if we ever..."
The Death was nodding. He seemed interested and kindly, but she couldn't for a moment forget what he was, her very own Death, and so close.
"I know it'll be an effort to go on now. And dangerous. But I want to, Death. I do, truly. And so does Will. We both had people taken away too soon. And we need to make amends. At least, I do."
"Everyone wishes they could speak again to those who've gone to the land of the dead. Why should there be an exception for you?"
"Because..."
she began, lying.
"Because there's something I've got to do there. Not just seeing my friend Roger... something else. It was a task put on me by an angel, and no one else can do it, only me. It's too important to wait till I die in the natural way. It's got to be done now. See, the angel commanded me. That's why we came here, me and Will. We got to."
Behind her, Tialis put away his instrument and sat watching the child plead with her own Death to be taken where no one should go. The Death scratched his head and held up his hands, but nothing could stop Lyra's words. Nothing could deflect her desire, not even fear. She'd seen worse than Death, she claimed. And she had, too. So eventually her Death said,
"If nothing can put you off, then all I can say is, come with me and I will take you there, into the land of the dead. I'll be your guide. I can show you the way in, but as for getting out again, you'll have to manage by yourself."
"And my friends, my friend Will and the others?"
"Lyra,"
said Tialis,
"against every instinct, we'll go with you. I was angry with you a minute ago, but you make it hard."
Lyra knew that this was a time to conciliate, and she was happy to do that, having got her way.
"Yes, I am sorry, Tialis, but if you hadn't got angry, we'd never have found this gentleman to guide us. So I'm glad you were here, you and the lady. I'm really grateful to you for being with us."
So Lyra persuaded her own Death to guide her and the others into the land where Roger had gone, and Will's father, and Tony Makarios, and so many others. And her Death told her to go down to the jetty when the first light came to the sky, and prepare to leave. But Pantalaimon was trembling and shivering, and nothing Lyra could do could soothe him into stillness, or quiet the soft little moan he couldn't help uttering. So her sleep was broken and shallow, on the floor of the shack with all the other sleepers, and her Death sat watchfully beside her. Chapter 20. climbing.
I gained it so, by climbing slow, by catching at the twigs that grow between the bliss and me. Emily Dickinson.
The Mulefa made many kinds of rope and cord, and Mary Malone spent a morning inspecting and testing the ones Atal's family had in their stores before choosing what she wanted. The principle of twisting and winding hadn't caught on in their world, so all the cords and ropes were braided. But they were strong and flexible, and Mary soon found exactly the sort she wanted.
"What are you doing?"
said Atal. The Mulefa had no term for climb, so Mary had to do a lot of gesturing and roundabout explaining. Atal was horrified.
"To go into the high part of the trees?"
"I must see what is happening,"
Mary explained.
"Now, you can help me prepare the rope."
Once in California, Mary had met a mathematician who spent every weekend climbing among the trees. Mary had done a little rock climbing, and she'd listened avidly as he had talked about the techniques and equipment. She decided to try it herself as soon as she had the chance. Of course, she'd never expected to be climbing trees in another universe, and climbing solo didn't greatly appeal either, but there was no choice about that. What she could do was make it as safe as possible beforehand. She took a coil long enough to reach over one of the branches of a high tree and back down to the ground, and strong enough to bear several times her weight. Then she cut a large number of short pieces of a smaller but very tough cord and made slings with them, short loops tied with a fisherman's knot, which could make hand and footholds when she tied them to the main line. Then there was the problem of getting the rope over the branch in the first place. An hour or two's experimenting with some fine tough cord and a length of springy branch produced a bow. The Swiss Army knife cut some arrows with stiff leaves in place of feathers to stabilize them in flight, and finally, after a day's work, Mary was ready to begin. But the sun was setting and her hands were tired, and she ate and slept, preoccupied, while the Mulefa discussed her endlessly in their quiet, musical whispers. First thing in the morning, she set off to shoot an arrow over a branch. Some of the Mulefa gathered to watch, anxious for her safety. Climbing was so alien to creatures with wheels that the very thought of it horrified them. Privately, Mary knew how they felt. She swallowed her nervousness and tied an end of the thinnest, lightest line to one of her arrows and sent it flying upwards from the bow. She lost the first arrow. It stuck in the bark part way up and wouldn't come out. She lost the second because, although it did clear the branch, it didn't fall far enough to reach the ground on the other side, and pulling it back she caught it and snapped it. The long line fell back attached to the broken shaft, and she tried again with the third and last, and this time it worked. Pulling carefully and steadily so as not to snag the line and break it, she hauled the prepared rope up and over until both ends were on the ground. Then she tied them both securely to a massive buttress of one of the roots, as thick around as her own hips, so it should be fairly solid, she thought. It had better be. What she couldn't tell from the ground, of course, was what kind of branch the whole thing, including her, would be depending on. Unlike climbing on rock, where you could fasten the rope to pitons on the cliff face every few yards so you never had far to fall, this business involved one very long free length of rope, and one very long fall if anything went wrong. To make herself a little more secure, she braided together three small ropes into a harness, and passed it around both hanging ends of the main rope with a loose knot that she could tighten the moment she began to slip. Mary put her foot in the first sling and began to climb. She reached the canopy in less time than she'd anticipated. The climbing was straightforward, the rope was kindly on her hands, and although she hadn't wanted to think about the problem of getting on top of the first branch, she found that the deep fissures and the bark helped her to get a solid purchase and feel secure. In fact, only 15 minutes after she'd left the ground, she was standing on the first branch and planning her route to the next. She had brought two more coils of rope with her, intending to make a web of fixed lines to serve in place of the pitons and anchors and friends, another hardware she relied on when climbing a rock face. Tying them in place took her some minutes more, and once she'd secured herself, she chose what looked like the most promising branch, coiled her spare rope again, and set off. After 10 minutes' careful climbing, she found herself right in the thickest part of the canopy. She could reach the long leaves and run them through her hands. She found flower after flower, off-white and absurdly small, each growing the little coin-sized thing that would later become one of those great iron-hard seed pods. She reached a comfortable spot where three branches forked, tied the rope securely, adjusted her harness, and rested. Through the gaps in the leaves, she could see the blue sea, clear and sparkling as far as the horizon. And in the other direction over her right shoulder, she could see the succession of low rises in the gold-brown prairie, laced across by the black highways. There was a light breeze, which lifted a faint scent out of the flowers and rustled the stiff leaves, and Mary imagined a huge, dim benevolence holding her up like a pair of giant hands. As she lay on the fork of the great branches, she felt a kind of bliss she had only felt once before, and that was not when she made her vows as a nun. Eventually she was brought back to her normal state of mind by a cramp in her right ankle, which was resting awkwardly in the crook of the fork. She eased it away and turned her attention to the task, still dizzy from the sense of oceanic gladness that surrounded her. She'd explained to the Mulefa how she had to hold the sap lacquer plates a hand span apart in order to see the thruff, and at once they'd seen the problem and made a short tube of bamboo, fixing the amber-coloured plates at each end like a telescope. This spyglass was tucked in her breast pocket, and she took it out now. When she looked through it, she saw those drifting golden sparkles, the sraf, the shadows, Lyra's dust, like a vast cloud of tiny beings floating through the wind. For the most part, they drifted randomly like dust motes in a shaft of sunlight or molecules in a glass of water. For the most part. But the longer she looked, the more she began to see another kind of motion. Underlying the random drifting was a deeper, slower, universal movement out from the land towards the sea. Well, that was curious. Securing herself to one of her fixed ropes, she crawled out along a horizontal branch, looking closely at all the flower heads she could find. And presently she began to see what was happening. She watched and waited till she was perfectly sure, and then began the careful, lengthy, strenuous process of climbing down. Mary found the Mulefa in a fearful state, having suffered a thousand anxieties for their friend so far off the ground. Atal was especially relieved and touched her nervously all over with her trunk, uttering gentle whinnies of pleasure to find her safe and carrying her swiftly down to the settlement along with a dozen or so others. As soon as they came over the brow of the hill, the call went out among those in the village, and by the time they reached the speaking ground, the throng was so thick that Mary guessed there were many visitors from elsewhere come to hear what she said. She wished she had better news for them. The old Zalif Satamax mounted the platform and welcomed her warmly, and she responded with all the Mulefa courtesy she could remember. As soon as the greetings were over, she began to speak. Haltingly and with many roundabout phrasings, she said,
"My good friends, I have been into the high canopy of your trees and looked closely at the growing leaves and the young flowers and the seed pods. I could see that there is a current of thraff high in the treetops, and it moves against the wind. The air is moving inland off the sea, but the thraff is moving slowly against it. Can you see that from the ground? Because I could not."
"No," said Satamax. "That is the first we ever heard about that."
"Well, the trees are filtering the thraff as it moves through them, and some of it is attracted to the flowers. I could see it happening. The flowers are turned upwards, and if the thraff were falling straight down, it would enter their petals and fertilize them like pollen from the stars. But the thraff isn't falling down. It's moving out towards the sea. When a flower happens to be facing the land, the thraff can enter it. That's why there are still some seed pods growing. But most of them face upwards, and the thraff just drifts past without entering. The flowers must have evolved like that, because in the past, all the thraff fell straight down. Something has happened to the thraff, not to the trees, and you can only see that current from high up, which is why you never knew about it. So if you want to save the trees and Mulefa life, we must find out why the thraff is doing that. I can't think of a way yet, but I will try."
She saw many of them craning to look upwards at this drift of dust, but from the ground you couldn't see it. She looked through the spyglass herself, but the dense blue of the sky was all she could see. They spoke for a long time, trying to recall any mention of the thraff wind among their legends and histories, but there was none. All they had ever known was that thraff came from the stars, as it had always done. Finally, they asked if Mary had any more ideas, and she said,
I need to make more observations. I need to find out whether the wind goes always in that direction, or whether it alters like the air currents during the day and the night. So I need to spend more time in the treetops, and sleep up there, and observe at night. I will need your help to build a platform of some kind, so I can sleep safely. But we do need more observations.
The Mulefa, practical and anxious to find out, offered at once to build her whatever she needed. They knew the techniques of using pulleys and tackle, and presently one suggested a way of lifting Mary easily into the canopy so as to save her the dangerous labor of climbing. Glad to have something to do, they set about gathering materials at once, braiding and tying and lashing spars and ropes and lines under her guidance, and assembling everything she needed for a treetop observation platform. After speaking to the old couple by the olive grove, Father Gomez lost the track. He spent several days searching and inquiring in every direction, but the woman seemed to have vanished completely. He would never have given up, although it was discouraging. The crucifix around his neck and the rifle at his back were twin tokens of his absolute determination to complete the task. But it would have taken him much longer if it hadn't been for a difference in the weather. In the world he was in, it was hot and dry, and he was increasingly thirsty. And seeing a wet patch of rock at the top of a scree, he climbed up to see if there was a spring there. There wasn't, but in the world of the wheel pod trees there had just been a shower of rain. And so it was that he discovered the window and found where Mary had gone. Chapter 21 The Harpies.
I hate things all fiction. There should always be some foundation of fact. Byron.
Lyra and Will each awoke with a heavy dread. It was like being a condemned prisoner on the morning fixed for the execution. Dialis and Salmakia were attending to their dragonflies, bringing them moths lassoed near the anbaric lamp over the oil drum outside, flies cut from spiderwebs, and water in a tin plate. When she saw the expression on Lyra's face, and the way that Pantalaimon, mouse-formed, was pressing himself close to her breast, the Lady Salmakia left what she was doing to come and speak with her. Will, meanwhile, left the hut to walk about outside.
You can still decide differently,
said Salmakia.
No, we can't. We decided already,
said Lyra, stubborn and fearful at once.
And if we don't come back?
You don't have to come.
We're not going to abandon you.
Then what if you don't come back?
We shall have died doing something important.
Lyra was silent. She hadn't really looked at the lady before, but she could see her very clearly now in the smoky light of the naphtha lamp, standing on the table just an arm's length away. Her face was calm and kindly, not beautiful, not pretty, but the very sort of face you would be glad to see if you were ill or unhappy or frightened. Her voice was low and expressive, with a current of laughter and happiness under the clear surface. In all the life she could remember, Lyra had never been read to in bed. No one had told her stories or sung nursery rhymes with her before kissing her and putting out the light. But she suddenly thought now that if ever there was a voice that would lap you in safety and warm you with love, it would be a voice like the Lady Salmakia's. And she felt a wish in her heart to have a child of her own, to lull and soothe and sing to, one day, in a voice like that.
Well,
Lyra said, and found her throat choked, so she swallowed and shrugged.
We'll see,
said the lady, and turned back. Once they had eaten their thin, dry bread and drunk their bitter tea, which was all the people had to offer them, they thanked their hosts, took their rucksacks, and set off through the shanty town for the lake shore. Lyra looked around for her death, and sure enough, there he was, walking politely a little way ahead. But he didn't want to come closer, though he kept looking back to see if they were following. The day was overhung with a gloomy mist. It was more like dusk than daylight, and wraiths and streamers of the fog rose dismally from puddles in the road, or clung like forlorn lovers to the anbaric cables overhead. They saw no people and few deaths, but the dragonflies skimmed through the damp air, as if they were sewing it all together with invisible threads, and it was a delight to the eyes to watch their bright colours flashing back and forth. Before long they had reached the edge of the settlement and made their way beside a sluggish stream through bare-twigged, scrubby bushes. Occasionally they would hear a harsh croak or a splash as some amphibian was disturbed, but the only creature they saw was a toad as big as Will's foot, which could only flop in a pain-filled sideways heave as if it were horribly injured. It lay across the path, trying to move out of the way and looking at them as if it knew they meant to hurt it.
"It would be merciful to kill it,"
said Tialis.
"How do you know?"
said Lyra.
"It might still like being alive, in spite of everything."
"If we killed it, we'd be taking it with us,"
said Will.
"It wants to stay here. I've killed enough living things. Even a filthy, stagnant pool might be better than being dead."
"But if it's in pain..."
"If it could tell us, we'd know. But since it can't, I'm not going to kill it. That would be considering our feelings, rather than the toad's."
They moved on. Before long, the changing sound their footsteps made told them that there was an openness nearby, although the mist was even thicker. Pantalaimon was a lemur, with the biggest eyes he could manage, clinging to Lyra's shoulder, pressing himself into her fog-pearled hair, peering all around and seeing no more than she did. And still he was trembling and trembling. Suddenly they all heard a little wave breaking. It was quiet, but it was very close by. The dragonflies returned with their riders to the children, and Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's breast as she and Will moved closer together, treading carefully along the slimy path. And then they were at the shore. The oily, scummy water lay still in front of them, an occasional ripple breaking languidly on the pebbles. The path turned to the left, and a little way along, more like a thickening of the mist than a solid object, a wooden jetty stood crazily out over the water. The piles were decayed and the planks were green with slime, and there was nothing else, nothing beyond it. The path ended where the jetty began, and where the jetty ended, the mist began. Lyra's death, having guided them there, bowed to her and stepped into the fog, vanishing before she could ask him what to do next.
"Listen,"
said Will. There was a slow, repetitive sound out on the invisible water, a creak of wood and a quiet, regular splash. Will put his hand on the knife at his belt and moved forward carefully onto the rotting planks. Lyra followed close behind. The dragonflies perched on the two weed-covered mooring posts, looking like heraldic guardians, and the children stood at the end of the jetty, pressing their open eyes against the mist and having to brush their lashes free of the drops that settled on them. The only sound was that slow creak and splash that was getting closer and closer.
"Come, let's go,"
Pantalaimon whispered.
"Got to,"
Lyra whispered back. She looked at Will. His face was set hard and grim and eager. He wouldn't turn aside. And the Gallivespians, Tialis on Will's shoulder, Salmakia on Lyra's, were calm and watchful. The dragonfly's wings were pearled with mist, like cobwebs, and from time to time they'd beat them quickly to clear them, because the drops must make them heavy, Lyra thought. She hoped there would be food for them in the land of the dead. Then, suddenly, there was the boat. It was an ancient rowboat, battered, patched, rotting, and the figure rowing it was aged beyond age, huddled in a robe of sacking bound with string, crippled and bent, his bony hands crooked permanently around the oar handles, and his moist, pale eyes sunk deep among folds and wrinkles of grey skin. He let go of an oar and reached his crooked hand up to the iron ring set in the post at the corner of the jetty. With the other hand he moved the oar to bring the boat right up against the planks. There was no need to speak. Will got in first, and then Lyra came forward to step down, too. But the boatman held up his hand.
"Not him,"
he said.
"Not who?"
"Not him."
He extended a yellow-grey finger, pointing directly at Pantalaimon, whose red-brown stoat form immediately became ermine-white.
"But he is me."
"If you come, he must stay."
"But we can't. We die."
"Isn't that what you want?"
And then, for the first time, Lyra truly realized what she was doing. This was the real consequence. She stood aghast, trembling, and clutched her dear demon so tightly that he whimpered in pain.
"They..."
said Lyra helplessly, then stopped. It wasn't fair to point out that the other three didn't have to give anything up. Will was watching her anxiously. She looked all around, at the lake, at the jetty, at the rough path, the stagnant puddles, the dead and sodden bushes. Her Pan, alone here. How could he live without her? He was shaking inside her shirt, against her bare flesh, his fur needing her warmth. Impossible! Never!
He must stay here if you are to come.
The Lady Salmakia flicked the rein, and her dragonfly skimmed away from Lyra's shoulder to land on the gunwale of the boat, where Tialis joined her. They said something to the boatman. Lyra watched as a condemned prisoner watches the stir at the back of the courtroom that might be a messenger with a pardon. The boatman bent to listen and then shook his head.
No! If she comes, he has to stay.
That's not right. We don't have to leave part of ourselves behind. Why should Lyra?
No, but you do. It's her misfortune that she can see and talk to the part she must leave. You will not know until you are on the water, and then it will be too late. But you all have to leave that part of yourselves here. There is no passage to the land of the dead for such as him.
No, Lyra thought, and Pantalaimon thought with her. We didn't go through Bolvanga for this. No. How will we ever find each other again? And she looked back again at the foul and dismal shore, so bleak and blasted with disease and poison, and thought of her dear Pan waiting there alone, her heart's companion, watching her disappear into the mist, and she fell into a storm of weeping. Her passionate sobs didn't echo because the mist muffled them, but all along the shore, in innumerable ponds and shallows, in wretched broken tree stumps, the damaged creatures that lurked there heard her full-hearted cry and drew themselves a little closer to the ground, afraid of such passion.
If he could come,
cried Will, desperate to end her grief, but the boatman shook his head.
He can come in the boat, but if he does, the boat stays here.
But how will she find him again?
I don't know.
When we leave, will we come back this way?
Leave?
We're going to come back. We're going to the land of the dead, and we are going to come back.
Not this way.
Then some other way, but we will.
I have taken millions, and none came back.
Then we shall be the first. We'll find our way out. And since we're going to do that, be kind, boatman. Be compassionate. Let her take her demon.
No.
He shook his ancient head.
It's not a rule you can break. It's a law, like this one.
He leaned over the side and cupped a handful of water and then tilted his hand so it ran out again.
The law that makes the water fall back into the lake. It's a law like that. I can't tilt my hand and make the water fly upward. No more can I take her demon to the land of the dead. Whether or not she comes, he must stay.
Lyra could see nothing. Her face was buried in Pantalaimon's cat fur. But Will saw Tialis dismount from his dragonfly and prepare to spring at the boatman, and he half agreed with the spy's intention. But the old man had seen him, and turned his ancient head to say,
How many ages do you think I've been ferrying people to the land of the dead? Do you think if anything could hurt me, it wouldn't have happened already? Do you think the people I take come with me gladly? They struggle and cry. They try to bribe me. They threaten and fight. Nothing works. You can't hurt me, sting as you will. Better comfort the child. She's coming. Take no notice of me.
Will could hardly watch. Lyra was doing the cruelest thing she had ever done. Hating herself, hating the deed, suffering for Pan and with Pan and because of Pan, trying to put him down on the cold path, disengaging his cat claws from her clothes, weeping, weeping. Will closed his ears. The sound was too unhappy to bear. Time after time she pushed her demon away, and still he cried and tried to cling. She could turn back. She could say, No, this is a bad idea, we mustn't do it. She could be true to the heart-deep, life-deep bond linking her to Pantalaimon. She could put that first. She could push the rest out of her mind. But she couldn't.
Pan, no one's done this before. But Will says we're coming back. And I swear, Pan, I love you. I swear we're coming back. I will. Take care, my dear. You'll be safe. We will come back. And if I have to spend every minute of my life finding you again, I will. I won't stop. I won't rest. I won't. Oh, Pan,
Dear Pan, I've got to.
And she pushed him away, so that he crouched bitter and cold and frightened on the muddy ground. What animal he was now, Will could hardly tell. He seemed to be so young, a cub, a puppy, something helpless and beaten, a creature so sunk in misery that it was more misery than creature. His eyes never left Lyra's face, and Will could see her making herself not look away, not avoid the guilt, and he admired her honesty and her courage at the same time as he was wrenched with the shock of their parting. There were so many vivid currents of feeling between them that the very air felt electric to him. And Pantalaimon didn't ask why, because he knew. And he didn't ask whether Lyra loved Roger more than him, because he knew the true answer to that, too. And he knew that if he spoke, she wouldn't be able to resist. So the demon held himself quiet so as not to distress the human who was abandoning him. And now they were both pretending that it wouldn't hurt, it wouldn't be long before they were together again. It was all for the best. But Will knew that the little girl was tearing her heart out of her breast. Then she stepped down into the boat. She was so light that it barely rocked at all. She sat beside Will, and her eyes never left Pantalaimon, who stood trembling at the shore end of the jetty. But as the boatman let go of the iron ring and swung his oars out to pull the boat away, the little dog demon trotted helplessly out to the very end, his claws clicking softly on the soft planks, and stood watching, just watching, as the boat drew away and the jetty faded and vanished in the mist. Then Lyra gave a cry so passionate that even in that muffled, mist-hung world it raised an echo. But of course it wasn't an echo. It was the other part of her crying in turn from the land of the living as Lyra moved away into the land of the dead.
My heart, Will!
She clung to him, her wet face contorted with pain. And thus the prophecy that the Master of Jordan College had made to the librarian, that Lyra would make a great betrayal and it would hurt her terribly, was fulfilled. But Will, too, found an agony building inside him, and through the pain he saw that the two Gallivespians, clinging together just as he and Lyra were doing, were moved by the same anguish. Part of it was physical. It felt as if an iron hand had gripped his heart and was pulling it out between his ribs, so that he pressed his hands to the place and vainly tried to hold it in. It was far deeper and far worse than the pain of losing his fingers. But it was mental, too. Something secret and private was being dragged into the open, where it had no wish to be, and Will was nearly overcome by a mixture of pain and shame and fear and self-reproach, because he himself had caused it. And it was worse than that. It was as if he'd said, "No, don't kill me, I'm frightened. Kill my mother instead. She doesn't matter, I don't love her." And as if she'd heard him say it, and pretended she hadn't so as to spare his feelings, and offered herself in his place anyway because of her love for him. He felt as bad as that. There was nothing worse to feel. So Will knew that all those things were part of having a demon, and that whatever his demon was, she, too, was left behind, with Pantalaimon, on that poisoned and desolate shore. The thought came to Will and Lyra at the same moment, and they exchanged a tear-filled glance. And for the second time in their lives, but not the last, each of them saw their own expression on the other's face. Only the boatman and the dragonflies seemed indifferent to the journey they were making. The great insects were fully alive and bright with beauty even in the clinging mist, shaking their filmy wings to dislodge the moisture. And the old man in his sacking robe leaned forward and back, bracing his bare feet against the slime-puddled floor. The journey lasted longer than Lyra wanted to measure. Though part of her was raw with anguish, imagining Pantalaimon abandoned on the shore, another part was adjusting to the pain, measuring her own strength, curious to see what would happen and where they would land. Will's arm was strong around her, but he too was looking ahead, trying to peer through the wet grey gloom and to hear anything other than the dank splash of the oars. And presently something did change. A cliff or an island lay ahead of them. They heard the enclosing of the sound before they saw the mist darken. The boatman pulled on one oar to turn the boat a little to the left.
"Where are we?"
said the voice of the Chevalier Tialis, small but strong as ever, though there was a harsh edge to it, as if he too had been suffering pain.
"Near the island,"
said the boatman.
"Another 5 minutes we'll be at the landing stage."
"What island?"
said Will. He found his own voice strained, too, so tight it hardly seemed his.
"The gate to the land of the dead is on this island. Everyone comes here.
Kings, queens, murderers, poets, children. Everyone comes this way, and none come back.
We shall come back.
The boatman said nothing, but his ancient eyes were full of pity. As they moved closer, they could see branches of cypress and yew hanging down low over the water, dark green, dense, and gloomy. The land rose steeply, and the trees grew so thickly that hardly a ferret could slip between them. And at that thought, Lyrie gave a little half-hiccup, half-sob, for Pan would have shown her how well he could do it. But not now. Maybe not ever again.
Are we dead now?
Makes no difference. There's some that came here never believing they were dead. They insisted all the way that they were alive. It was a mistake. Someone would have to pay. Made no difference. There's others who longed to be dead when they were alive, poor souls. Lives full of pain or misery, killed themselves for a chance of a blessed rest, and found that nothing had changed except for the worse. And this time, there was no escape. You can't make yourself alive again. And there's been others, so frail and sickly, little infants sometimes, that they're scarcely born into the living before they come down to the dead. I've rowed this boat with a little crying baby on my lap many, many times, that never knew the difference between up there and down here. And old folk, too. The rich ones are the worst, snarling and savage and cursing me, railing and screaming. What did I think I was? Hadn't they gathered and saved all the gold they could garner? Wouldn't I take some now to put them back ashore? They'd have the law on me. They had powerful friends. They knew the Pope and the King of this and the Duke of that. They were in a position to see I was punished and chastised. But they knew what the truth was in the end. The only position they were in was in my boat, going to the land of the dead. And as for those kings and popes, they'd be in here too in their turn, sooner than they wanted. I let him cry and rave. They can't hurt me. They fall silent in the end. So if you don't know whether you're dead or not, and the little girl swears blind she'll come out again to the living, I say nothing to contradict you. What you are, you'll know soon enough.
All the time he had been steadily rowing along the shore, and now he shipped the oars, slipping the handles down inside the boat and reaching out to his right for the first wooden post that rose out of the lake. He pulled the boat alongside the narrow wharf and held it still for them. Lyra didn't want to get out. As long as she was near the boat, then Pantalaimon would be able to think of her properly because that was how he last saw her. But when she moved away from it, he wouldn't know how to picture her anymore. So she hesitated, but the dragonflies flew up, and Will got out, pale and clutching his chest. So she had to as well.
Thank you,
she said to the boatman.
When you go back, if you see my demon, tell him I love him the best of everything in the land of the living or the dead. And I swear I'll come back to him, even if no one's ever done it before. I swear I will.
Yes, I'll tell him that, said the old boatman.
He pushed off and the sound of his slow oar strokes faded away in the mist. The Gallivespians flew back, having gone a little way, and perched on the children's shoulders as before, she on Lyra, he on Will. So they stood, the travellers, at the edge of the land of the dead. Ahead of them there was nothing but mist, though they could see from the darkening of it that a great wall rose in front of them. Lyra shivered. She felt as if her skin had turned into lace and the damp and bitter air could flow in and out of her ribs, scaldingly cold on the raw wound where Pantalaimon had been. Still, she thought, Roger must have felt like that as he plunged down the mountainside, trying to cling to her desperate fingers. They stood still and listened. The only sound was an endless drip, drip, drip of water from the leaves, and as they looked up they felt one or two drops splash coldly on their cheeks.
Can't stay here,
said Lyra. They moved off the wharf, keeping close together, and made their way to the wall. Gigantic stone blocks, green with ancient slime, rose higher into the mist than they could see. And now that they were closer, they could hear the sound of cries behind it, though whether they were human voices crying was impossible to tell. High, mournful shrieks and wails that hung in the air like the drifting filaments of a jellyfish, causing pain wherever they touched.
"There's a door,"
said Will. It was a battered wooden postern under a slab of stone. Before Will could lift his hand and open it, one of those high, harsh cries sounded very close by, jarring their ears and frightening them horribly. Immediately the Gallivespians darted into the air, the dragonflies like little war horses eager for battle. But the thing that flew down swept them aside with a brutal blow from her wing and then settled heavily on a ledge just above the children's heads. Dialis and Salmakia gathered themselves and soothed their shaken mounts. The thing was a great bird, the size of a vulture, with the face and breasts of a woman. Will had seen pictures of creatures like her, and the word harpy came to mind as soon as he saw her clearly. Her face was smooth and unwrinkled, but aged beyond even the age of the witches. She had seen thousands of years pass, and the cruelty and misery of all of them had formed the hateful expression on her features. But as the travellers saw her more clearly, she became even more repulsive. Her eye sockets were clotted with filthy slime, and the redness of her lips was caked and crusted as if she had vomited ancient blood again and again. Her matted, filthy black hair hung down to her shoulders. Her jagged claws gripped the stone fiercely. Her powerful dark wings were folded along her back, and a drift of putrescent stink wafted from her every time she moved. Will and Lyra, both of them sick and full of pain, tried to stand upright and face her.
"But you are alive!"
the harpy said, her harsh voice mocking them. Will found himself hating and fearing her more than any human being he had ever known.
"Who are you?"
said Lyra, who was just as repelled as Will. For answer, the harpy screamed. She opened her mouth and directed a jet of noise right in their faces, so that their heads rang and they nearly fell backwards. Will clutched at Lyra, and they both clung together as the scream turned into wild, mocking peals of laughter, which were answered by other harpy voices in the fog along the shore. The jeering, hate-filled sound reminded Will of the merciless cruelty of children in a playground. But there were no teachers here to regulate things, no one to appeal to, nowhere to hide. He set his hand on the knife at his belt and looked her in the eyes, though his head was ringing and the sheer power of her scream had made him dizzy.
"If you're trying to stop us, then you'd better be ready to fight as well as scream, because we're going through that door."
The harpy's sickening red mouth moved again, but this time it was to purse her lips into a mock kiss.
"Your mother is alone. We shall send her nightmares. We shall scream at her in her sleep."
Will didn't move, because out of the corner of his eye he could see the Lady Salmakia moving delicately along the branch where the harpy was perching. Her dragonfly, wings quivering, was being held by Tialis on the ground. And then two things happened. The lady leapt at the harpy and spun around to dig her spur deep into the creature's scaly leg, and Tialis launched the dragonfly upwards. In less than a second, Salmakia had spun away and leapt off the branch, directly onto the back of her electric blue steed and up into the air. The effect on the harpy was immediate. Another scream shattered the silence, much louder than before, and she beat her dark wings so hard that Will and Lyra both felt the wind and staggered. But she clung to the stone with her claws, and her face was suffused with dark red anger, and her hair stood out from her head like a crest of serpents. Will tugged at Lyra's hand, and they both tried to run towards the door, but the harpy launched herself at them in a fury and only pulled up from the dive when Will turned, thrusting Lyra behind him and holding up the knife. The Gallivespians were on her at once, darting close at her face and then darting away again, unable to get in a blow but distracting her so that she beat her wings clumsily and half fell onto the ground.
"Tialis! Salmakia! Stop! Stop!"
The spies reined back their dragonflies and skimmed high over the children's heads. Other dark forms were clustering in the fog, and the jeering screams of 100 more harpies sounded from further along the shore. The first one was shaking her wings, shaking her hair, stretching each leg in turn and flexing her claws. She was unhurt, and that was what Lyra had noticed. The Gallivespians hovered and then dived back towards Lyra, who was holding out both hands for them to land on. Salmakia realized what Lyra had meant and said to Tialis,
"She's right. We can't hurt her for some reason."
"Lady, what's your name?"
The harpy shook her wings wide, and the travellers nearly fainted from the hideous smells of corruption and decay that wafted from her.
No name!
What do you want with us?
What can you give me?
We could tell you where we've been, and maybe you'd be interested. I don't know. We saw all kinds of strange things on the way here.
Oh? And you're offering to tell me a story?
If you'd like.
Maybe I would. And what then?
You might let us go in through that door and find the ghost we've come here to look for. I hope you would anyway, if you'd be so kind.
Try, then.
And even in her sickness and pain, Lyra felt that she'd just been dealt the ace of trumps.
Oh, be careful,
whispered Salmakia. But Lyra's mind was already racing ahead through the story she'd told the night before, shaping and cutting and improving and adding, parents dead, family treasure, shipwreck, escape.
Well,
she said, settling into her storytelling frame of mind.
It began when I was a baby, really. My father and mother were the Duke and Duchess of Abingdon, you see, and they were as rich as anything. My father was one of the king's advisers, and the king himself used to come and stay, oh, all the time. They'd go hunting in our forest. The house there, where I was born, it was the biggest house in the whole south of England. It was called...
Without even a cry of warning, the harpy launched herself at Lyra, claws outstretched. Lyra just had time to duck, but still one of the claws caught her scalp and tore out a clump of hair.
Liar! Liar! Liar!
She flew around again, aiming directly for Lyra's face, but Will took out the knife and threw himself in the way. No Name swerved out of reach just in time, and Will hustled Lyra over towards the door because she was numb with shock and half-blinded by the blood running down her face. Where the Gallivespians were, Will had no idea, but the harpy was flying at them again and screaming in rage and hatred.
Liar! Liar! Liar!
And it sounded as if her voice were coming from everywhere, and the word echoed back from the great wall in the fog, muffled and changed, so that she seemed to be screaming Lyra's name, so that Lyra and Liar were one and the same thing. Will had Lyra pressed against his chest, with his shoulder curved over to protect her, and he felt her shaking and sobbing against him. But then he thrust the knife into the rotten wood of the door and cut out the lock with a quick slash of the blade. Then he and Lyra, with the spies beside them on their darting dragonflies, tumbled through into the realm of the ghosts as the harpy's cry was doubled and redoubled by others on the foggy shore behind them. Chapter 22 The Whisperers.
Thick as autumnal leaves that strow the brooks in Vallombrosa, where the Etrurian shades high overarched embower. John Milton.
The first thing Will did was to make Lyra sit down, and then he took out the little pot of blood moss ointment and looked at the wound on her head. It was bleeding freely, as scalp wounds do, but it wasn't deep. He tore a strip off the edge of his shirt and mopped it clean, and spread some of the ointment over the gash, trying not to think of the filthy state of the claw that made it. Lyra's eyes were glazed, and she was ash pale.
Lyra! Lyra!
He said, and shook her gently.
Come on now, we've got to move.
She gave a shudder and took a long, shaky breath, and her eyes focused on him, full of a wild despair.
Will, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. I can't tell lies. I thought it was so easy, but it didn't work. It's all I can do and it doesn't work.
It's not all you can do. You can read the alethiometer, can't you? Come on, let's see where we are. Let's look for Roger.
He helped her up, and for the first time they looked around at the land where the ghosts were. They found themselves on a great plain that extended far ahead into the mist. The light by which they saw was a dull self-luminescence that seemed to exist everywhere equally, so that there were no true shadows and no true light, and everything was the same dingy colour. Standing on the floor of this huge space were adults and children, ghost people, so many that Lyra couldn't guess their number. At least, most of them were standing, though some were sitting and some lying down, listless or asleep. No one was moving about or running or playing, though many of them turned to look at these new arrivals with a fearful curiosity in their wide eyes.
Ghosts! This is where they all are! Everyone that's ever died!
No doubt it was because she didn't have Pantalaimon anymore, but she clung close to Will's arm, and he was glad she did. The Gallivespians had flown ahead, and he could see their bright little forms darting and skimming over the heads of the ghosts, who looked up and followed them with wonder. But the silence was immense and oppressive, and the grey light filled him with fear, and Lyra's warm presence beside him was the only thing that felt like life. Behind them, outside the wall, the screams of the harpies were still echoing up and down the shore. Some of the ghost people were looking up apprehensively, but more of them were staring at Will and Lyra, and then they began to crowd forward. Lyra shrank back. She didn't have the strength just yet to face them as she would have liked to do, and it was Will who had to speak first.
"Do you speak our language? Can you speak at all?"
Shivering and frightened and full of pain as he and Lyra were, they had more authority than the whole mass of the dead put together. These poor ghosts had little power of their own, and hearing Will's voice, the first clear voice that had sounded there in all the memory of the dead, many of them came forward, eager to respond. But they could only whisper. A faint, pale sound, no more than a soft breath, was all they could utter. And as they thrust forward, jostling and desperate, the Gallivespians flew down and darted to and fro in front of them to prevent them from crowding too close. The ghost children looked up with a passionate longing, and Lyra knew at once why. They thought the dragonflies were demons. They were wishing with all their hearts that they could hold their own demons again.
"Oh, they ain't demons. And if my own demon was here, you could all stroke him and touch him, I promise."
And she held out her hands to the children. The adult ghosts hung back, listless or fearful, but the children all came thronging forward. They had as much substance as fog, poor things, and Lyra's hands passed through and through them, as did Will's. They crammed forward, light and lifeless, to warm themselves at the flowing blood and the strong beating hearts of the two travellers, and both Will and Lyra felt a succession of cold, delicate brushing sensations as the ghosts passed through their bodies, warming themselves on the way. The two living children felt that little by little they were becoming dead too. They hadn't got an infinite amount of life and warmth to give, and they were so cold already, and the endless crowds pressing forward looked as if they were never going to stop. Finally, Lyra had to plead with them to hold back. She held up her hands and said,
"Please, we wish we could touch you all, but we came down here to look for someone, and I need you to tell me where he is and how to find him. Oh, Will,"
she said, leaning her head to his,
"I wish I knew what to do."
The ghosts were fascinated by the blood on Lyra's forehead. It glowed as brightly as a holly berry in the dimness, and several of them had brushed through it, longing for the contact with something so vibrantly alive. One ghost girl, who when she was alive must have been about 9 or 10, reached up shyly to try and touch it, and then shrank back in fear. But Lyra said,
"Don't be afraid. We ain't come here to hurt you. Speak to us, if you can."
The ghost girl spoke, but in her thin, pale voice it was only a whisper.
"Did the harpies do that? Did they try and hurt you?"
"Yeah,"
said Lyra.
"But if that's all they can do, I ain't worried about them."
"Oh, it isn't... Oh, they do worse."
"What? What do they do?"
But they were reluctant to tell her. They shook their heads and kept silent, until one boy said,
It ain't so bad for them that's been here hundreds of years, because you get tired after all that time. They can't afraid you up so much."
"It's the new ones that they like talking to most. It's just... Oh, it's just hateful. They... I can't tell you."
Their voices were no louder than dry leaves falling. And it was only the children who spoke. The adults all seemed sunk in a lethargy so ancient that they might never move or speak again.
"Listen, please listen. We came here, me and my friends, because we got to find a boy called Roger. He ain't been here long, just a few weeks, so he won't know very many people. But if you know where he is..."
But even as she spoke, she knew that they could stay here till they grew old, searching everywhere and looking at every face, and still they might never see more than a tiny fraction of the dead. She felt despair sit on her shoulders, as heavy as if the harpy herself were perching there. However, she clenched her teeth and tried to hold her chin high. "We got here," she thought. "That's part of it anyway." The first ghost girl was saying something in that lost little whisper.
"Why do we want to find him?"
said Will.
Well, Lyra wants to speak to him, but there's someone I want to find as well. I want to find my father, John Parry. He's here too somewhere, and I want to speak to him before I go back to the world. So please ask, if you can, ask for Roger and for John Parry to come and speak to Lyra and to Will. Ask them...
But suddenly the ghosts all turned and fled, even the grown-ups, like dry leaves scattered by a sudden gust of wind. In a moment, the space around the children was empty, and then they heard why. Screams, cries, shrieks came from the air above, and then the harpies were on them with gusts of rotten stink, battering wings, and those raucous screams, jeering, mocking, cackling, deriding. Lyra shrank to the ground at once, covering her ears, and Will, knife in hand, crouched over her. He could see Tialis and Salmakia skimming towards them, but they were some way off yet, and he had a moment or two to watch the harpies as they wheeled and dived. He saw their human faces snap at the air as if they were eating insects, and he heard the words they were shouting, scoffing words, filthy words, all about his mother, words that shook his heart. But part of his mind was quite cold and separate, thinking, calculating, observing. None of them wanted to come anywhere near the knife. To see what would happen, he stood up. One of them, it might have been No Name herself, had to swerve heavily out of the way because she'd been diving low, intending to skim just over his head. Her heavy wings beat clumsily, and she only just made the turn. He could have reached out and slashed off her head with the knife. By this time, the Gallivespians had arrived, and the two of them were about to attack, but Will called,
"Tialis, come here. Salmakia, come to my hand."
They landed on his shoulders, and he said,
"Watch. See what they do. They only come and scream. I think it was a mistake when she hit Lyra. I don't think they want to touch us at all. We can ignore them."
Lyra looked up, wide-eyed. The creatures flew around Will's head, sometimes only a foot or so away, but they always swerved aside or upwards at the last moment. He could sense the two spies eager for battle, and the dragonfly's wings were quivering with desire to dart through the air with their deadly riders, but they held themselves back. They could see he was right. And it had an effect on the ghosts, too. Seeing Will standing unafraid and unharmed, they began to drift back towards the travellers. They watched the harpies cautiously, but for all that, the lure of the warm flesh and blood, those strong heartbeats, was too much to resist. Lyra stood up to join Will. Her wound had opened again, and fresh blood was trickling down her cheek, but she wiped it aside.
"Will, I'm so glad we came down here together."
He heard a tone in her voice, and he saw an expression on her face that he knew and liked more than anything he'd ever known. It showed she was thinking of something daring, but she wasn't ready to speak of it yet. He nodded to show he'd understood. The ghost girl said,
"This way. Come with us. We'll find them."
And both of them felt the strangest sensation, as if little ghost hands were reaching inside and tugging at their ribs to make them follow. So they set off across the floor of that great desolate plain, and the harpies wheeled higher and higher overhead, screaming and screaming. But they kept their distance, and the Gallivespians flew above, keeping watch. As they walked along, the ghosts talked to them.
"Excuse me,"
said one ghost girl.
"But where's your demons? Excuse me for asking, but..."
Lyra was conscious every single second of her dear abandoned Pantalaimon. She couldn't speak easily, so Will answered instead.
"We left our demons outside, where it's safe for them. We'll collect them later. Did you have a demon?"
"Yes, his name was Sandling. Oh, I loved him."
"And had he settled?"
said Lyra.
"No, not yet. He used to think he'd be a bird, and I hoped he wouldn't, because I liked him all furry in bed at night. But he was a bird more and more. What's your demon called?"
Lyra told her, and the ghosts pressed forward eagerly again. They all wanted to talk about their demons, every one.
"Mine was called Matapan.
We used to play hide and seek. She changed like a chameleon, and I couldn't see her at all. She was ever so good.
Once I hurt my eye, and I couldn't see, and he guided me all the way home.
He never wanted to settle, but I wanted to grow up, and we used to argue.
She used to curl up in my hand and go to sleep."
"Are they still there? Somewhere else? Will we see them again?"
"No. When you die, your demon just goes out like a candle flame. I seen it happen. I never saw my caster, though. I never said goodbye."
"They ain't nowhere. They must be somewhere. My demon's still there, somewhere. I know he is."
The jostling ghosts were animated and eager, their eyes shining and their cheeks warm, as if they were borrowing life from the travellers. Will said,
Is there anyone here from my world, where we don't have demons?
A thin ghost boy of his own age nodded, and Will turned to him.
Oh, yes. We didn't understand what demons were, but we knew what it felt like to be without them. There's people here from all kinds of worlds.
I knew my dad. I knew him all the while I was growing up. When I heard them talk about demons, I thought they meant something like our deaths. I miss him now. I will never see him again. I'm over and done with, that's the last thing he said to me, and then he went forever. When he was with me, I always knew there was someone I could trust, someone who knew where we was going and what to do. But I ain't got him no more. I don't know what's going to happen ever again.
There ain't nothing going to happen. Nothing forever.
You don't know. They came, didn't they? No one ever knew that was going to happen.
She meant Will and Lara.
This is the first thing that ever happened here. Maybe it's all going to change now.
What would you do if you could?
Said Lara.
Go up to the world again.
Even if it meant you could only see it once, would you still want to do that?
Yes!
Well, anyway, I've got to find Roger.
Said Lara, burning with her new idea. But it was for Will to know first. On the floor of the endless plain, there was a vast, slow movement among the uncountable ghosts. The children couldn't see it, but Tialis and Salmakia, flying above, watched the little pale figures all moving with an effect that looked like the migration of immense flocks of birds or herds of reindeer. At the centre of the movement were the two children who were not ghosts, moving steadily on. Not leading and not following, but somehow focusing the movement into an intention of all the dead. The spies, their thoughts moving even more quickly than their darting steeds, exchanged a glance and brought the dragonflies to rest side by side on a dry, withered branch.
Do we have demons, Tialis?
Since we got into that boat, I have felt as if my heart had been torn out and thrown still beating on the shore. But it wasn't. It's still working in my breast. So something of mine is out there with the little girl's demon, and something of yours too, Salmakia, because your face is drawn and your hands are pale and tight. Yes, we have demons, whatever they are. Maybe the people in Lyra's world are the only living beings to know they have. Maybe that's why it was one of them who started the revolt.
He slipped off the dragonfly's back and tethered it safely, and then took out the lodestone resonator. But he had hardly begun to touch it when he stopped.
No response.
So we're beyond everything?
Beyond help, certainly. Well, we knew we were coming to the land of the dead.
The boy would go with her to the end of the world.
Will his knife open the way back, do you think?
I'm sure he thinks so. But, oh, Tialis, I don't know.
He's very young. Well, they are both young. You know, if she doesn't survive this, the question of whether she'll choose the right thing when she's tempted won't arise. It won't matter anymore.
Do you think she's chosen already? When she chose to leave her demon on the shore, was that the choice she had to make?
The Chevalier looked down on the slow-moving millions on the floor of the Land of the Dead, all drifting after that bright and living spark Lyra Silvertongue. He could just make out her hair, the lightest thing in the gloom, and beside it the boy's head, black-haired and solid and strong.
No, not yet. That's still to come, whatever it may be.
Then we must bring her to it safely.
Bring them both. They're bound together now.
The Lady Salmakia flicked the cobweb light rein, and her dragonfly darted off the branch at once and sped down towards the living children, with the Chevalier close behind. But they didn't stop with them. Having skimmed low to make sure they were all right, they flew on ahead, partly because the dragonflies were restless, and partly because they wanted to find out how far this dismal place extended. Lyra saw them flashing overhead, and felt a pang of relief that there was still something that darted and glowed with beauty. Then, unable to keep her idea to herself anymore, she turned to Will, but she had to whisper. She put her lips to his ear, and in a noisy rush of warmth, he heard her say,
Will, I want us to take all these poor dead ghost kids outside. The grown-ups as well. We could set them free. We'll find Roger and your father, and then let's open the way to the world outside and set them all free.
He turned and gave her a true smile, so warm and happy she felt something stumble and falter inside her. At least it felt like that, but without Pantalaimon she couldn't ask herself what it meant. It might have been a new way for her heart to beat. Deeply surprised, she told herself to walk straight and stop feeling giddy. So they moved on. The whisper, Roger, was spreading out faster than they could move. The words, "Roger, Lyra's come. Roger, Lyra's here," passed from one ghost to another like the electric message that one cell in the body passes on to the next. And Tialis and Salmakia, cruising above on their tireless dragonflies, and looking all around as they flew, eventually noticed a new kind of movement. Some way off, there was a little gyration of activity. Skimming down closer, they found themselves ignored for the first time because something more interesting was gripping the minds of all the ghosts. They were talking excitedly in their near-silent whispers. They were pointing. They were urging someone forwards. Salmakia flew down low but couldn't land. The press was too great, and none of their hands or shoulders would support her, even if they dared to try. She saw a young ghost boy with an honest, unhappy face, dazed and puzzled by what he was being told, and she called out,
"Roger? Is that Roger?"
He looked up, bemused, nervous, and nodded. Salmakia flew back up to her companion, and together they sped back to Lyra. It was a long way and hard to navigate, but by watching the patterns of movement, they finally found her.
"There she is. Lyra! Lyra, your friend is there!"
Lyra looked up and held out her hand for the dragonfly. The great insect landed at once, its red and yellow gleaming like enamel, and its filmy wings stiff and still on either side. Tialis kept his balance as she held him at eye level.
"Where? Is he far off?"
"An hour's walk. But he knows you're coming. The others have told him, and we made sure it was him. Just keep going, and soon you'll find him."
Tialis saw Will make the effort to stand up straight and force himself to find some more energy. Lyra was charged with it already and plied the Gallivespians with questions. How did Roger seem? Had he spoken to them? No, of course. But did he seem glad? Were the other children aware of what was happening, and were they helping, or were they just in the way? And so on. Tialis tried to answer everything truthfully and patiently. And step by step, the living girl drew closer to the boy she had brought to his death. Chapter 23. No Way Out.
"And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The Gospel of St. John.
"Will,"
said Lyra,
"what do you think the harpies will do when we let the ghosts out?"
Because the creatures were getting louder and flying closer, and there were more and more of them all the time, as if the gloom were gathering itself into little clots of malice and giving them wings. The ghosts kept looking up fearfully.
"Are we getting close?"
Lyra called to the Lady Salmakia.
"Not far now,"
she called down, hovering above them.
"You could see him if you climbed that rock."
But Lyra didn't want to waste time. She was trying with all her heart to put on a cheerful face for Roger, but every moment in front of her mind's eye was that terrible image of the little dog Pan, abandoned on the jetty as the mist closed around him, and she could barely keep from howling. She must, though. She must be hopeful for Roger. She always had been. When they did come face to face, it happened quite suddenly. In among the press of all the ghosts, there he was, his familiar features wan, but his expression as full of delight as a ghost could be. He rushed to embrace her, but he passed like cold smoke through her arms, and though she felt his little hand clutch at her heart, it had no strength to hold on. They could never truly touch again. But he could whisper, and his voice said,
"Lyra, I never thought I'd ever see you again. I thought even if you did come down here when you was dead, you'd be much older. You'd be a grown-up, and you wouldn't want to speak to me."
"Why ever not?"
"Because I'd done the wrong thing when Pan got my demon away from Lord Asriel's. We should have run. We shouldn't have tried to fight her. We should have run to you. Then she wouldn't have been able to get my demon again. And when the cliff fell away, my demon would have still been with me."
"But that weren't your fault, stupid. It was me that brung you there in the first place, and I should have let you go back with the other kids and the Egyptians. It was my fault. I'm so sorry, Roger. Honest, it was my fault. You wouldn't have been here otherwise."
"Well, I don't know. Maybe I would have got dead some other way. But it weren't your fault, Lyra, see?"
She felt herself beginning to believe it. But all the same, it was heart-rending to see the poor little cold thing, so close and yet so out of reach. She tried to grasp his wrist, though her fingers closed in the empty air, but he understood and sat down beside her. The other ghosts withdrew a little, leaving them alone, and Will moved apart too to sit down and nurse his hand. It was bleeding again, and while Tialis flew fiercely at the ghosts to force them away, Salmakia helped Will tend to the wound. But Lyra and Roger were oblivious to that.
And you ain't dead. How'd you come here if you're still alive? And where's Pan?
Oh, Roger, I had to leave him on the shore. It was the worst thing I ever had to do. It hurts so much. You know how it hurts. And he just stood there, just looking... Oh, I felt like a murderer, Roger. But I had to, or else I couldn't have come.
I've been pretending to talk to you all the time since I died. I've been wishing I could and wishing so hard. Just wishing I could get out. Me and all the other deadens. Because this is a terrible place, Lyra. It's hopeless. There's no change when you're dead. And them bird things, you know what they do? They wait till you're resting. You can't never sleep properly. You just sort of doze, and they come up quiet beside you, and they whisper all the bad things you ever did when you was alive, so you can't forget them. They know all the worst things about you. They know how to make you feel horrible, just thinking of all the stupid things and bad things you ever did. And all the greedy and unkind thoughts you ever had, they know them all. And they shame you up, and they make you feel sick with yourself. But you can't get away from them.
Well, listen.
Dropping her voice and leaning closer to the little ghost, just as she used to do when they were planning mischief at Jordan, she went on.
You probably don't know, but the witches... You remember Serafina Pekala? The witches have got a prophecy about me. They don't know I know. No one does. I never spoke to anyone about it before. But when I was in Trollesund, and Farda Corum, the Egyptian, took me to see the witch's consul, Dr. Lansalius, he gave me like a kind of a test. He said I had to go outside and pick out the right piece of cloud pine out of all the others to show I could really read the alethiometer. Well, I done that, and then I came in quickly because it was cold, and it only took a second, it was easy. The consul was talking to Farda Corum, and they didn't know I could hear him. He said the witches had this prophecy about me. I was going to do something great and important, and it was going to be in another world. Only I never spoke of it, and I reckon I must have even forgot it. There was so much else going on, so it sort of sunk out of my mind. I never even talked about it with Pan, because he would have laughed, I reckon. But then, later on, Mrs. Coulter caught me, and I was in a trance, and I was dreaming. And I dreamed of that, and I dreamed of you. And I remembered the Egyptian boat mother, Marcosta, you remember? It was their boat we got on board of, in Jericho, with Simon and Hugh and them.
Yes, and we nearly sailed it to Abingdon. That was the best thing we ever done, Lyra. I won't never forget that, even if I'm down here dead for 1,000 years.
Yes, but listen, when I ran away from Mrs. Coulter the first time, right, I found the Egyptians again, and they looked after me and... Oh, Roger, there's so much I found out. You'd be amazed. But this is the important thing. Ma Costa said to me, she said I'd got witch oil in my soul. She said the Egyptians were water people, but I was a fire person. And what I think that means is she was sort of preparing me for the witch prophecy. I know I got something important to do. And Dr. Lansalius, the consul, said it was vital I never found out what my destiny was till it happened, see? I must never ask about it. So I never did. I never even thought what it might be. I never asked the alethiometer even. But now I think I know. And finding you again is just a sort of proof. What I got to do, Roger, what my destiny is I got to help all the ghosts out of the land of the dead forever. Me and Will, we got to rescue you all. I'm sure it's that. It must be. And because Lord Asriel, because of something my father said, death is going to die, he said. I don't know what'll happen, though. You mustn't tell him yet, promise. I mean, you might not last up there, but...
That's just what I wanted to tell you. I told them, all the other deadens, I told them you'd come, just like you came and rescued the kids from Bulvanga. I says Lyra'll do it if anyone can. They wished it to be true. They wanted to believe me, but they never really did, I could tell. For one thing, every kid that's ever come here, every single one, starts by saying,
I bet my dad'll come and get me. Or I bet my mum, as soon as she knows where I am, she'll fetch me home again. If it ain't their dad or mum, it's their friends or their grandpa, but someone's going to come and rescue him. Only they never do. So no one believed me when I told them you'd come. Only I was right.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't have done it without Will. That's Will, over there. And that's the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. There's so much to tell you, Roger.
Who's Will? Where's he come from?
Lyra began to explain, quite unaware of how her voice changed, how she sat up straighter, and how even her eyes looked different when she told the story of her meeting with Will and the fight for the subtle knife. How could she have known? But Roger noticed, with the sad, voiceless envy of the unchanging dead. Meanwhile, Will and the Gallivespians were a little way off, talking quietly.
What are you going to do, you and the girl?
Open this world and let the ghosts out. That's what I've got the knife for.
He had never seen such astonishment on any faces, let alone those of people whose good opinion he valued. He'd acquired a great respect for these two. They sat silent for a few moments, and then Tialis said,
This will undo everything. It's the greatest blow you could strike. The authority will be powerless after this.
How would they ever suspect it? It'll come at them out of nowhere.
And what then?
What then? Well, then we'll have to get out ourselves and find our demons, I suppose. Don't think of then. It's enough to think of now. I haven't said anything to the ghosts in case it doesn't work. So don't you say anything either. Now, I'm going to find a world I can open, and those harpies are watching. So if you want to help, you can go and distract them while I do that.
Instantly, the Gallivespians urged their dragonflies up into the murk overhead, where the harpies were as thick as blowflies. Will watched the great insects charging fearlessly up at them, for all the world as if the harpies were flies and they could snap them up in their jaws, big as they were. He thought how much the brilliant creatures would love it when the sky was open and they could skim about over bright water again. Then he took up the knife, and instantly there came back the words the harpies had thrown at him, taunts about his mother, and he stopped. He put the knife down, trying to clear his mind. He tried again, with the same result. He could hear them clamouring above, despite the ferocity of the Gallivespians. There were so many of them that two flyers alone could do little to stop them. Well, this was what it was going to be like. It wasn't going to get any easier. So Will let his mind relax and become disengaged, and just sat there with the knife held loosely until he was ready again. This time the knife cut straight into the air and met rock. He had opened a window in this world into the underground of another. He closed it up and tried again. And the same thing happened, though he knew it was a different world. He'd opened windows before to find himself above the ground of another world, so he shouldn't have been surprised to find he was underground for a change. But it was disconcerting. Next time he felt carefully in the way he'd learned, letting the tip search for the resonance that revealed a world where the ground was in the same place. But the touch was wrong wherever he felt. There was no world anywhere he could open into. Everywhere he touched, it was solid rock. Lyra had sensed that something was wrong, and she jumped up from her close conversation with Roger's ghost to hurry to Will's side.
What is it?
We're going to have to move somewhere else before I can find a world we can open into, and those harpies aren't going to let us. Have you told the ghosts what we were planning?
No, only Roger, and I told him to keep it quiet. He'll do whatever I tell him. Will, I'm scared. I'm so scared. We might not ever get out. Suppose we get stuck here forever.
The knife can cut through rock. If we need to, we'll just cut a tunnel. It'll take a long time, and I hope we won't have to. But we could. Don't worry.
Yeah, you're right. Of course we could.
But she thought he looked so ill, with his face drawn in pain and with dark rings around his eyes, and his hand was shaking, and his fingers were bleeding again. He looked as sick as she felt. They couldn't go on much longer without their demons. She felt her own ghost quail in her body and hugged her arms tightly, aching for Pan. Meanwhile, the ghosts were pressing close, poor things, and the children especially couldn't leave Lyra alone.
Please, you won't forget us when you go back, will you?
No, never.
You'll tell them about us.
I promise. What's your name?
But the poor girl was embarrassed and ashamed. She'd forgotten. She turned away, hiding her face, and a boy said,
It's better to forget, I reckon. I've forgotten mine. Some ain't been here long, and they still know who they are.
The Sun Kid's been here thousands of years. They're no older than us, and they've forgotten a whole lot. Except the sunshine. No one forgets that. And the wind.
Yeah, tell us about that.
And more of them clamoured for Lyra to tell them about the things they remembered, the sun and the wind and the sky, and the things they'd forgotten, such as how to play. And she turned to Will.
What should I do, Will?
Tell them.
I'm scared. After what happened back there, the harpies...
Tell them the truth. We'll keep the harpies off.
She looked at him doubtfully. In fact, she felt sick with apprehension. She turned back to the ghosts who were thronging closer and closer.
Please?
You've just come from the world.
Tell us about the world.
There was a tree not far away, just a dead trunk with its bone-white branches thrusting into the chilly grey air. And because Lyra was feeling weak, and because she didn't think she could walk and talk at the same time, she made for that so as to have somewhere to sit. The crowd of ghosts jostled and shuffled aside to make room. When she and Will were nearly at the tree, Tialis landed on Will's hand and indicated that he should bend his head to listen.
They're coming back, those harpies. More and more of them. Have your knife ready. The lady and I will hold them off as long as we can, but you might need to fight.
Without worrying Lyra, Will loosened the knife in its sheath and kept his hand close to it. Tialis took off again, and then Lyra reached the tree and sat down on one of the thick roots. So many dead figures clustered around, pressing hopefully, wide-eyed, that Will had to make them keep back and leave room. But he let Roger stay close, because he was gazing at Lyra, listening with a passion. And Lyra began to talk about the world she knew. She told them the story of how she and Roger had climbed over Jordan College roof and found the rook with the broken leg, and how they had looked after it until it was ready to fly again, and how they had explored the wine cellars, all thick with dust and cobwebs, and drunk some canary, or it might have been tokai, she couldn't tell, and how drunk they had been. And Roger's ghost listened, proud and desperate, nodding and whispering,
"Yes, yes, that's just what happened. That's true, all right."
Then she told them all about the great battle between the Oxford townies and the clay burners. First she described the clay beds, making sure she got in everything she could remember, the wide ochre-coloured washing pits, the dragline, the kilns like great brick beehives. She told them about the willow trees along the river's edge with their leaves all silvery underneath. And she told how, when the sun shone for more than a couple of days, the clay began to split up into great handsome plates with deep cracks between, and how it felt to squish your fingers into the cracks and slowly lever up a dried plate of mud, trying to keep it as big as you could without breaking it. Underneath it was still wet, ideal for throwing at people. And she described the smells around the place, the smoke from the kilns, the rotten leaf mould smell of the river when the wind was in the southwest, the warm smell of the baking potatoes the clay burners used to eat, and the sound of the water slipping slickly over the sluices and into the washing pits, and the slow, thick suck as you tried to pull your foot out of the ground, and the heavy, wet slap of the gate paddles in the clay-thick water. As she spoke, playing on all their senses, the ghosts crowded closer, feeding on her words, remembering the time when they had flesh and skin and nerves, and willing her never to stop. Then she told how the Clayburners' children always made war on the townies, but how they were slow and dull, with clay in their brains, and how the townies were as sharp and quick as sparrows by contrast, and how one day all the townies had swallowed their differences and plotted and planned and attacked the clay beds from three sides, pinning the clay burners' children back against the river, hurling handfuls and handfuls of heavy, claggy clay at one another, rushing their muddy castle and tearing it down, turning the fortifications into missiles until the air and the ground and the water were all mixed inextricably together, and every child looked exactly the same, mud from scalp to sole, and none of them had had a better day in all their lives. When she'd finished, she looked at Will, exhausted. Then she had a shock. As well as the ghosts, silent all around, and her companions, close and living, there was another audience, too. The branches of the tree were clustered with those dark bird forms, their women's faces gazing down at her, solemn and spellbound. She stood up in sudden fear, but they didn't move.
You flew at me before when I tried to tell you something. What's stopping you now? Go on, tear at me with your claws and make a ghost out of me.
That is the least we shall do,
said the harpy in the centre, who was no name herself.
Listen to me. Thousands of years ago, when the first ghosts came down here, the authority gave us the power to see the worst in everyone, and we have fed on the worst ever since, till our blood is rank with it and our very hearts are sickened. But still, it was all we had to feed on. It was all we had. And now we learn that you are planning to open a way to the upper world and lead all the ghosts out into the air.
And her harsh voice was drowned by a million whispers as every ghost who could hear cried out in joy and hope. But all the harpies screamed and beat their wings until the ghosts fell silent again.
Yes, to lead them out. What will we do now? I shall tell you what we will do. From now on, we shall hold nothing back. We shall hurt and defile and tear and rend every ghost that comes through. And we shall send them mad with fear and remorse and self-hatred. This is a wasteland now. We shall make it a hell!
Every single harpy shrieked and jeered, and many of them flew up off the tree and straight at the ghosts, making them scatter in terror. Lyra clung to Will's arm.
They've given it away now, and we can't do it. They'll hate us. They'll think we betrayed them. We've made it worse, not better.
Quiet, said Dialis.
Don't despair. Call the harpies back and make them listen to us.
Come back! Come back, every one of you! Come back and listen!
One by one, the harpies, their faces eager and hungry and suffused with a lust for misery, turned and flew back to the tree, and the ghosts drifted back as well. The Chevalier left his dragonfly in the care of Salmakia, and his little tense figure, green-clad and dark-haired, leapt to a rock where they could all see him.
Harpies, we can offer you something better than that. Answer my questions truly, and hear what I say, and then judge. When Lyra spoke to you outside the wall, you flew at her. Why did you do that?
Lies! Lies and fantasies!
Yet when she spoke just now, you all listened, every one of you, and you kept silent and still. Again, why was that?
Because it was true. Because she spoke the truth. Because it was nourishing. Because it was feeding us. Because we couldn't help it. Because it was true. Because we had no idea that there was anything but wickedness. Because it brought us news of the world and the sun and the wind and the rain. Because it was true.
Then let's make a bargain with you. Instead of seeing only the wickedness and cruelty and greed of the ghosts that come down here, from now on, you will have the right to ask all the ghosts to tell you the stories of their lives. And they will have to tell the truth about what they've seen and touched and heard and loved and known in the world. Every one of these ghosts has a story. Every single one that comes down in the future will have true things to tell you about the world. And you'll have the right to hear them. And they will have to tell you.
Lyra marvelled at the nerve of the little spy. How did he dare speak to these creatures as if he had the power to give them rights? Any one of them could have snapped him up in a moment, wrenched him apart in her claws, or carried him high and then hurled him down to the ground to smash in pieces. And yet there he stood, proud and fearless, making a bargain with them. And they listened and conferred, their faces turning to one another, their voices low. All the ghosts watched, fearful and silent. Then No Name turned back.
That's not enough. We want more than that. We had a task under the old dispensation. We had a place under duty. We fulfilled the authority's commands diligently, and for that we were honoured. Hated and feared, but honoured too. What will happen to our honour now? Why should the ghosts take any notice of us if they can simply walk out into the world again? We have our pride, and you should not let that be dispensed with. We need an honourable place. We need a duty and a task to do, one that will bring us the respect we deserve.
They shifted on the branches, muttering and raising their wings. But a moment later, Salmakia leapt up to join the Chevalier.
You are quite right. Everyone should have a task to do that's important, one that brings them honour, one they can perform with pride. So here is your task, and it's one that only you can do, because you are the guardians and the keepers of this place. Your task will be to guide the ghosts from the landing place by the lake all the way through the land of the dead to the new opening out into the world. In exchange, they will tell you their stories as a fair and just payment for this guidance. Does that seem right to you?
Noname looked at her sisters, and they nodded.
And we have the right to refuse to guide them if they lie, or if they hold anything back, or if they have nothing to tell us. If they live in the world, they should see and touch and hear and learn things. We shall make an exception for infants who have not had time to learn anything. But otherwise, if they come down here bringing nothing, we shall not guide them out.
That is fair,
said Salmakia, and the other travellers agreed. So they made a treaty, and in exchange for the story of Lyra's that they'd already heard, the Harpies offered to take the travellers and their knife to a part of the land of the dead where the upper world was close. It was a long way off, through tunnels and caves, but they would guide them faithfully, and all the ghosts could follow. But before they could begin, a voice cried out, as loudly as a whisper could cry. It was the ghost of a thin man with an angry, passionate face, and he cried,
"What will happen? When we leave the world of the dead, will we live again, or will we vanish as our demons did? Brothers, sisters, we shouldn't follow this child anywhere till we know what's going to happen to us."
"Yes, tell us where we're going."
"Tell us what to expect."
"We won't go unless we know what'll happen to us."
"Tell us!
Tell us! Tell us!"
Lyra turned to Will in despair, but he said,
"Tell them the truth. Ask the alethiometer and tell them what it says."
"All right."
She took out the golden instrument. The answer came at once. She put it away and stood up.
"This is what'll happen. And it's true. Perfectly true. When you go out of here, all the particles that make you up will loosen and float apart, just like your demons did. If you've seen people dying, you know what that looks like. But your demons aren't just nothing now. They're part of everything. All the atoms that were them, they've gone into the air and the wind and the trees and the earth and all the living things. They'll never vanish. They're just part of everything. And that's exactly what'll happen to you, I swear to you. I promise on my honour. You'll drift apart, it's true. But you'll be out in the open, part of everything alive again."
No one spoke. Those who had seen how demons dissolved were remembering it, and those who hadn't were imagining it. And no one spoke until a young woman came forward. She had died as a martyr centuries before. She looked around and said to the other ghosts,
"When we were alive, they told us that when we died, we'd go to heaven. And they said that heaven was a place of joy and glory, and we would spend eternity in the company of saints and angels, praising the Almighty in a state of bliss. That's what they said. And that's what led some of us to give our lives and others to spend years in solitary prayer, while all the joy of life was going to waste around us, and we never knew. Because the land of the dead isn't a place of reward or a place of punishment. It's a place of nothing. The good come here, as well as the wicked, and all of us languish in this gloom forever, with no hope of freedom or joy or sleep or rest or peace. But now this child has come, offering us a way out, and I'm going to follow her. Even if it means oblivion, friends, I'll welcome it, because it won't be nothing. We'll be alive again.
and 1,000 blades of grass and 1,000,000 leaves. We'll be falling in the raindrops and blowing in the fresh breeze. We'll be glittering in the dew under the stars and the moon out there in the physical world, which is our true home and always was. So I urge you, come with the child out to the sky.
But her ghost was thrust aside by the ghost of a man who looked like a monk, thin and pale, with dark, zealous eyes even in his death. He crossed himself and murmured a prayer, and then he said,
"This is a bitter message, a sad and cruel joke. Can't you see the truth? This is not a child. This is an agent of the evil one himself. The world we lived in was a veil of corruption and tears. Nothing there could satisfy us. But the Almighty has granted us this blessed place for all eternity, this paradise, which to the fallen soul seems bleak and barren, but which the eyes of faith see as it is, overflowing with milk and honey and resounding with the sweet hymns of the angels. This is heaven, truly. What this evil girl promises is nothing but lies. She wants to lead you to hell. Go with her at your peril. My companions and I of the true faith will remain here in our blessed paradise and spend eternity singing the praises of the Almighty, who has given us the judgment to tell the false from the true."
Once again he crossed himself, and then he and his companions turned away in horror and loathing. Lyra felt bewildered. Was she wrong? Was she making some great mistake? She looked around. Gloom and desolation on every side. But she'd been wrong before about the appearance of things, trusting Mrs. Coulter because of her beautiful smile and her sweet-scented glamour. It was so easy to get things wrong, and without her demon to guide her, maybe she was wrong about this, too. But Will was shaking her arm. Then he put his hands to her face and held it roughly.
"You know that's not true. Just as well as you can feel this. Take no notice. They can all see he's lying too, and they're depending on us. Come on, let's make a start."
She nodded. She had to trust her body and the truth of what her senses told her. She knew Pan would have. So they set off, and the numberless millions of ghosts began to follow them. Behind them, too far back for the children to see, other inhabitants of the world of the dead had heard what was happening and were coming to join the great march. Tialis and Salmakia flew back to look and were overjoyed to see their own people there and every other kind of conscious being who had ever been punished by the Authority with exile and death. Among them were beings who didn't look human at all, beings like the Mulefa, whom Mary Malone would have recognized, and stranger ghosts as well. But Will and Lyra had no strength to look back. All they could do was move on after the harpies and hope.
"Have we almost done it, Will? Is it nearly over?"
He couldn't tell. But they were so weak and sick that he said,
"Yes, it's nearly over. We've nearly done it. We'll be out soon."
Chapter 24. Mrs. Coulter in Geneva.
As is the mother, so is her daughter. The Book of Ezekiel.
Mrs. Coulter waited till nightfall before she approached the College of St. Jerome. After darkness had fallen, she brought the intention craft down through the cloud and moved slowly along the lake shore at treetop height. The college was a distinctive shape among the other ancient buildings of Geneva, and she soon found the spire, the dark hollow of the cloisters, the square tower where the president of the Consistorial Court of Discipline had his lodging. She had visited the college 3 times before. She knew that the ridges and gables and chimneys of the roof concealed plenty of hiding places, even for something as large as the intention craft. Flying slowly above the tiles, which glistened with the recent rain, she edged the machine into a little gully between a steep tiled roof and the sheer wall of the tower. The place was only visible from the belfry of the Chapel of the Holy Penitents nearby. It would do very well. She lowered the aircraft delicately onto the roof, letting its 6 feet find their own purchase and adjust themselves to keep the cabin level. She was beginning to love this machine. It sprang to her bidding as fast as she could think, and it was so silent. It could hover above people's heads closely enough for them to touch, and they'd never know it was there. In the day or so since she'd stolen it, Mrs. Coulter had mastered the controls, but she still had no idea how it was powered, and that was the only thing she worried about. She had no way of telling when the fuel or the batteries would run out. Once she was sure it had settled, and that the roof was solid enough to support it, she took off the helmet and climbed down. Her demon was already prizing up one of the heavy old tiles. She joined him, and soon they had lifted half a dozen out of the way, and then she snapped off the battens on which they'd been hung, making a gap big enough to get through.
"Go in and look around,"
she whispered, and the demon dropped through into the dark. She could hear his claws as he moved carefully over the floor of the attic, and then his gold-fringed black face appeared in the opening. She understood at once and followed him through, waiting to let her eyes adjust. In the dim light, she gradually saw a long attic where the dark shapes of cupboards, tables, bookcases, and furniture of all kinds had been put into storage. The first thing she did was to push a tall cupboard in front of the gap where the tiles had been. Then she tiptoed to the door in the wall at the far end and tried the handle. It was locked, of course, but she had a hairpin, and the lock was simple. 3 minutes later, she and her demon were standing at one end of a long corridor, where a dusty skylight let them see a narrow staircase descending at the other. And 5 minutes after that, they had opened a window in the pantry next to the kitchen 2 floors below, and climbed out into the alley. The gatehouse of the college was just around the corner, and as she said to the golden monkey, it was important to arrive in the orthodox way, no matter how they intended to leave.
"Take your hands off me,"
she said calmly to the guard.
"And show me some courtesy, or I shall have you flayed. Tell the president that Mrs. Coulter has arrived and that she wishes to see him at once."
The man fell back, and his pincher demon, who had been baring her teeth at the mild-mannered golden monkey, instantly cowered and tucked her tail stump as low as it would go. The guard cranked the handle of a telephone, and under a minute later a fresh-faced young priest came hastening into the gatehouse, wiping his palms on his robe in case she wanted to shake hands. She didn't.
"Who are you?"
"Brother Louis,"
said the man, soothing his rabbit demon.
"Convener of the Secretariat of the Consistorial Court. If you would be so kind..."
"I haven't come here to parley with a scrivener. Take me to Father MacPhail and do it now."
The man bowed helplessly and led her away. The guard behind her blew out his cheeks with relief. Brother Louis, after trying 2 or 3 times to make a conversation, gave up and led her in silence to the president's rooms in the tower. Father MacPhail was at his devotions, and poor Brother Louis's hand shook violently as he knocked. They heard a sigh and a groan, and then heavy footsteps crossed the floor. The president's eyes widened as he saw who it was, and he smiled wolfishly.
"Mrs. Coulter,"
he said, offering his hand.
"I am very glad to see you. My study is cold, and our hospitality is plain, but come in. Come in."
"Good evening,"
she said, following him inside the bleak stone-walled room, allowing him to make a little fuss and show her to a chair.
"Thank you,"
she said to Brother Louis, who was still hovering.
"I'll take a glass of chocolatl."
Nothing had been offered, and she knew how insulting it was to treat him like a servant, but his manner was so abject that he deserved it. The president nodded, and Brother Louis had to leave and deal with it, to his great annoyance.
"Of course you are under arrest,"
said the president, taking the other chair and turning up the lamp.
"Oh, why spoil our talk before we've even begun? I came here voluntarily, as soon as I could escape from Azrael's fortress. The fact is, Father President, I have a great deal of information about his forces and about the child, and I came here to give it to you."
"The child, then. Begin with the child."
"My daughter is now 12 years old. Very soon she will approach the cusp of adolescence. And then it will be too late for any of us to prevent the catastrophe. Nature and opportunity will come together like spark and tinder. Thanks to your intervention, that is now far more likely. I hope you're satisfied."
"It was your duty to bring her here into our care. Instead, you chose to skulk in a mountain cave. Though how a woman of your intelligence hoped to remain hidden is a mystery to me."
"There's probably a great deal that's mysterious to you, my Lord President, starting with the relations between a mother and her child. If you thought for one moment that I would release my daughter into the care of a body of men with a feverish obsession with sexuality, men with dirty fingernails, reeking of ancient sweat, men whose furtive imaginations would crawl over her body like cockroaches, if you thought I would expose my child to that, my Lord President, you are more stupid than you take me for."
There was a knock on the door before he could reply, and Brother Louis came in with 2 glasses of chocolatl on a wooden tray. He laid the tray on the table with a nervous bow, smiling at the president in hopes of being asked to stay. But Father MacPhail nodded towards the door, and the young man left reluctantly.
"So what were you going to do?"
said the president.
"I was going to keep her safe until the danger had passed."
"What danger would that be?"
he said, handing her a glass.
"Oh, I think you know what I mean. Somewhere there is a tempter. A serpent, so to speak. And I had to keep them from meeting."
"There is a boy with her."
"Yes, and if you hadn't interfered, they would both be under my control. As it is, they could be anywhere. At least they're not with Lord Asriel."
"I have no doubt he will be looking for them. The boy has a knife of extraordinary power. They would be worth pursuing for that alone."
"I'm aware of that. I managed to break it, and he managed to get it mended again."
The president wondered why she was smiling. Surely she didn't approve of this wretched boy.
"We know."
"Well, well. Fra Pavel must be getting quicker. When I knew him, it would have taken him a month at least to read all that."
She sipped her chocolatl, which was thin and weak. How like these wretched priests, she thought, to take their self-righteous abstinence out on their visitors, too.
"Tell me about Lord Asriel. Tell me everything."
Mrs. Coulter settled back comfortably and began to tell him. Not everything, but he never thought for a moment that she would. She told him about the fortress, about the allies, about the angels, about the mines and the foundries. Father MacPhail sat without moving a muscle, his lizard demon absorbing and remembering every word.
"And how did you get here?"
"I stole a gyropter. It ran out of fuel and I had to abandon it in the countryside not far from here. The rest of the way I walked."
"Is Lord Asriel actively searching for the girl and the boy?"
"Of course."
"I assume he's after that knife. You know it has a name. The cliff ghasts of the north call it the God Destroyer,"
he went on, crossing to the window and looking down over the cloisters.
"That's what Asriel is aiming to do, isn't it? Destroy the authority. There are some people who claim that God is dead already. Presumably Asriel is not one of those, if he retains the ambition to kill him."
"Well, where is God if he's alive? And why doesn't he speak anymore? At the beginning of the world, God walked in the garden and spoke with Adam and Eve. Then he began to withdraw, and he forbade Moses to look at his face. Later in the time of Daniel, he was aged. He was the Ancient of Days. Where is he now? Is he still alive, at some inconceivable age, decrepit and demented, unable to think or act or speak and unable to die, a rotten hulk? And if that is his condition, wouldn't it be the most merciful thing, the truest proof of our love for God, to seek him out and give him the gift of death?"
Mrs. Coulter felt a calm exhilaration as she spoke. She wondered if she'd ever get out alive, but it was intoxicating to speak like that to this man.
"And dust? From the depths of heresy, what is your view of dust?"
"I have no view of dust. I don't know what it is. No one does."
"I see. Well, I began by reminding you that you are under arrest. I think it's time we found you somewhere to sleep. You'll be quite comfortable. No one will hurt you. But you're not going to get away, and we shall talk more tomorrow."
He rang a bell, and Brother Louis came in almost at once.
"Show Mrs. Coulter to the best guest room, and lock her in."
The best guest room was shabby, and the furniture was cheap, but at least it was clean. After the lock had turned behind her, Mrs. Coulter looked around at once for the microphone, and found one in the elaborate light fitting, and another under the frame of the bed. She disconnected them both, and then had a horrible surprise. Watching her from the top of the chest of drawers behind the door was Lord Roke. She cried out and put a hand on the wall to steady herself. The Gallivespian was sitting cross-legged, entirely at his ease, and neither she nor the golden monkey had seen him. Once the pounding of her heart had subsided and her breathing had slowed, she said,
"And when would you have done me the courtesy of letting me know you were here, my lord? Before I undressed or afterwards?"
"Before. Tell your demon to calm down or I'll disable him."
The golden monkey's teeth were bared and all his fur was standing on end. The scorching malice of his expression was enough to make any normal person quail, but Lord Roke merely smiled. His spurs glittered in the dim light. The little spy stood up and stretched.
"I've just spoken to my agent in Lord Asriel's fortress. Lord Asriel presents his compliments and asks you to let him know as soon as you find out what these people's intentions are.
She felt winded, as if Lord Asriel had thrown her hard in wrestling. Her eyes widened, and she sat down slowly on the bed.
Did you come here to spy on me, or to help?
Both. And it's lucky for you I'm here. As soon as you arrived, they set some ambaric work in motion down in the cellars. I don't know what it is, but there's a team of scientists working on it right now. You seem to have galvanized them.
I don't know whether to be flattered or alarmed. As a matter of fact, I'm exhausted, and I'm going to sleep. If you're here to help me, you can keep watch. You can begin by looking the other way.
He bowed and faced the wall until she had washed in the chipped basin, dried herself on the thin towel, and undressed and got into bed. Her demon patrolled the room, checking the wardrobe, the picture rail, the curtains, the view of the dark cloisters out of the window. Lord Roke watched him every inch of the way. Finally, the golden monkey joined Mrs. Coulter, and they fell asleep at once. Lord Roke hadn't told her everything that he'd learned from Lord Asriel. The Allies had been tracking the flight of all kinds of beings in the air above the frontiers of the Republic, and had noticed a concentration of what might have been angels, and might have been something else entirely, in the west. They had sent patrols out to investigate, but so far they had learned nothing. Whatever it was that hung there had wrapped itself in impenetrable fog. The spy thought it best not to trouble Mrs. Coulter with that, though. She was exhausted. Let her sleep, he decided, and he moved silently about the room, listening at the door, watching out of the window, awake and alert. An hour after she had first come into the room, he heard a quiet noise outside the door, a faint scratch and a whisper. At the same moment, a dim light outlined the door. Lord Roke moved to the furthest corner and stood behind one of the legs of the chair on which Mrs. Coulter had thrown her clothes. A minute went by, and then the key turned very quietly in the lock. The door opened an inch, no more, and then the light went out. Lord Roke could see well enough in the dim glow through the thin curtains, but the intruder was having to wait for his eyes to adjust. Finally, the door opened further, very slowly, and the young priest, Brother Louis, stepped in. He crossed himself and tiptoed to the bed. Lord Roke prepared to spring, but the priest merely listened to Mrs. Coulter's steady breathing, looked closely to see whether she was asleep, and then turned to the bedside table. He covered the bulb of the battery light with his hand and switched it on, letting a thin gleam escape through his fingers. He peered at the table so closely that his nose nearly touched the surface, but whatever he was looking for, he didn't find it. Mrs. Coulter had put a few things there before she got into bed, a couple of coins, a ring, her watch, but Brother Louis wasn't interested in those. He turned to her again, and then he saw what he was looking for, uttering a soft hiss between his teeth. Lord Roke could see his dismay. The object of his search was the locket on the gold chain around Mrs. Coulter's neck. Lord Roke moved silently along the skirting board towards the door. The priest crossed himself again, for he was going to have to touch her. Holding his breath, he bent over the bed, and the golden monkey stirred. The young man froze, hands outstretched. His rabbit demon trembled at his feet. No use at all. She could at least have kept watch for the poor man, Lord Roke thought. The monkey turned over in his sleep and fell still again. After a minute, poised like a waxwork, Brother Louis lowered his shaking hands to Mrs. Coulter's neck. He fumbled for so long that Lord Roke thought the dawn would break before he got the catch undone, but finally he lifted the locket gently away and stood up. Lord Roke, as quick and as quiet as a mouse, was out of the door before the priest had turned around. He waited in the dark corridor, and when the young man tiptoed out and turned the key, the Gallivespian began to follow him. Brother Louis made for the tower, and when the president opened his door, Lord Roke darted through and made for the prie-dieu in the corner of the room. There he found a shadowy ledge where he crouched and listened. Father MacPhail was not alone. Fra Pavel, the alethiometrist, was busy with his books, and another figure stood nervously by the window. This was Dr. Cooper, the experimental theologian from Bolvanger. They both looked up.
"Well done, Brother Louis," said the president. "Bring it here, sit down, show me. Well done."
Fra Pavel moved some of his books, and the young priest laid the gold chain on the table. The others bent over to look as Father MacPhail fiddled with the catch. Dr. Cooper offered him a pocket knife, and then there was a soft click.
Ah,
sighed the president. Lord Roke climbed to the top of the desk so that he could see. In the naphtha lamplight there was a gleam of dark gold. It was a lock of hair, and the president was twisting it between his fingers, turning it this way and that.
Are we certain this is the child's?
I am certain,
came the weary voice of Fra Pavel.
And is there enough of it, Dr. Cooper?
The pale-faced man bent low and took the lock from Father MacPhail's fingers. He held it up to the light.
Oh, yes. One single hair would be enough. This is ample.
I'm very pleased to hear it. Now, Brother Louis, you must return the locket to the good lady's neck.
The priest sagged faintly. He had hoped his task was over. The president placed the curl of Lyra's hair in an envelope and shut the locket, looking up and around as he did so, and Lord Roke had to drop out of sight.
Father President,
said Brother Louis,
I shall, of course, do as you command. But may I know why you need the child's hair?
No, Brother Louis, because it would disturb you. Leave these matters to us. Off you go.
The young man took the locket and left, smothering his resentment. Lord Roke thought of going back with him and waking Mrs. Coulter just as he was trying to replace the chain, in order to see what she'd do. But it was more important to find out what these people were up to. As the door closed, the Galivespian went back into the shadows and listened.
How did you know where she had it?
Said the scientist.
Every time she mentioned the child, her hand went to the locket. Now then, how soon can it be ready?
A matter of hours.
And the hair? What do you do with that?
We place the hair in the resonating chamber. You understand, each individual is unique, and the arrangement of genetic particles quite distinct. Well, as soon as it's analysed, the information is coded in a series of anbaric pulses and transferred to the aiming device. That locates the origin of the material, the hair, wherever she may be. It's a process that actually makes use of the Barnard-Stokes heresy, the many worlds idea.
Don't alarm yourself, Doctor. Fra Pavel has told me that the child is in another world. Please, go on. The force of the bomb is directed by means of the hair.
Yes, to each of the hairs from which these ones were cut, that's right.
So, when it's detonated, the child will be destroyed wherever she is.
Yes. The power needed is enormous. The anbaric power. Just as an atomic bomb needs a high explosive to force the uranium together and set off the chain reaction, this device needs a colossal current to release the much greater power of the severance process. I was wondering...
It doesn't matter where it's detonated, does it?
No, that is the point. Anywhere will do.
And it's completely ready.
Now we have the hair, yes. But the power, you see...
I've seen to that. The hydro-anbaric generating station at Saint-Jean-les-Eaux has been requisitioned for our use. They produce enough power there, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Then we shall set out at once. Please go and see to the apparatus, Dr. Cooper. Have it ready for transportation as soon as you can. The weather changes quickly in the mountains, and there is a storm on the way.
The scientist took the little envelope containing Lyra's hair and bowed nervously as he left. Lord Roke left with him, making no more noise than a shadow. As soon as they were out of earshot of the president's room, the Galivespian sprang. Dr. Cooper, below him on the stairs, felt an agonizing stab in his shoulder and grabbed for the banister, but his arm was strangely weak, and he slipped and tumbled down the whole flight to land semi-conscious at the bottom. Lord Roke hauled the envelope out of the man's twitching hand with some difficulty, for it was half as big as he was, and set off in the shadows towards the room where Mrs. Coulter was asleep. The gap at the foot of the door was wide enough for him to slip through. Brother Louis had come and gone, but he hadn't dared to try and fasten the chain around Mrs. Coulter's neck. It lay beside her on the pillow. Lord Roke pressed her hand to wake her up. She was profoundly exhausted, but she focused on him at once and sat up, rubbing her eyes. He explained what had happened and gave her the envelope.
You should destroy it at once. One single hair would be enough, the man said.
She looked at the little curl of dark blonde hair and shook her head.
Too late for that. This is only half the lock I cut from Lyra. He must have kept back some of it.
Lord Roke hissed with anger.
When he looked around, I moved to be out of his sight. He must have set it aside then.
And there's no way of knowing where he'll have put it. Still, if we can find the bomb...
Shh!
That was the golden monkey. He was crouching by the door, listening, and then they heard it too, heavy footsteps hurrying towards the room. Mrs. Coulter thrust the envelope and the lock of hair at Lord Roke, who took it and leapt for the top of the wardrobe. Then she lay down next to her demon as the key turned noisily in the door.
"Where is it? What have you done with it? How did you attack Dr. Cooper?"
said the President as the light fell across the bed. Mrs. Coulter threw up an arm to shade her eyes and struggled to sit up.
"You do like to keep your guests entertained. Is this a new game? What do I have to do, and who is Dr. Cooper?"
The guard from the gatehouse had come in with Father MacPhail and was shining a torch into the corners of the room and under the bed. The President was slightly disconcerted. Mrs. Coulter's eyes were heavy with sleep, and she could hardly see in the glare from the corridor light. It was obvious that she hadn't left her bed.
"You have an accomplice. Someone has attacked a guest of the college. Who is it? Who came here with you? Where is he?"
"I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about. And what's this?"
Her hand, which she'd put down to help herself sit up, had found the locket on the pillow. She stopped, picked it up, and looked at the President with wide-open, sleepy eyes, and Lord Roke saw a superb piece of acting as she said,
"But this is my... What's it doing here? Father MacPhail, who's been in here? Someone has taken this from around my neck, and... Where is Lyra's hair? There was a lock of my child's hair in here. Who's taken it? Why? What's going on?"
And now she was standing, her hair disordered, passion in her voice, plainly just as bewildered as the President himself. Father MacPhail took a step backwards and put his hand to his head.
"Someone else must have come with you. There must be an accomplice. Where is he hiding?"
"I have no accomplice. If there's an invisible assassin in this place, I can only imagine it's the devil himself. I dare say he feels quite at home."
Father MacPhail said to the guard,
"Take her to the cellars. Put her in chains. I know just what we can do with this woman. I should have thought of it as soon as she appeared."
She looked wildly around and met Lord Roke's eyes for a fraction of a second, glittering in the darkness near the ceiling. He caught her expression at once and understood exactly what she meant him to do. Chapter 25. Saint-Jean-les-Eaux.
A bracelet of bright hair about the bone. John Donne.
The cataract of Saint-Jean-les-Eaux plunged between pinnacles of rock at the eastern end of a spur of the Alps, and the generating station clung to the side of the mountain above it. It was a wild region, a bleak and battered wilderness, and no one would have built anything there at all had it not been for the promise of driving great anbaric generators with the power of the thousands of tons of water that roared through the gorge. It was the night following Mrs. Coulter's arrest, and the weather was stormy. Near the sheer stone front of the generating station, a Zeppelin slowed to a hover in the buffeting wind. The searchlights below the craft made it look as if it were standing on several legs of light and gradually lowering itself to lie down. But the pilot wasn't satisfied. The wind was swept into eddies and cross gusts by the edges of the mountain. Besides, the cables, the pylons, the transformers were too close. To be swept in among them with a Zeppelin full of inflammable gas would be instantly fatal. Sleet drummed slantwise at the great rigid envelope of the craft, making a noise that almost drowned the clatter and howl of the straining engines and obscuring the view of the ground.
"Not here!"
the pilot shouted over the noise.
"We'll go around the spur!"
Father MacPhail watched fiercely as the pilot moved the throttle forward and adjusted the trim of the engines. The Zeppelin rose with a lurch and moved over the rim of the mountain. Those legs of light suddenly lengthened and seemed to feel their way down the ridge, their lower ends lost in the whirl of sleet and rain.
"You can't get closer to the station than this,"
said the President, leaning forward to let his voice carry to the pilot.
"Not if you want to land."
"Yes, we want to land. Very well, put us down below the ridge."
The pilot gave orders for the crew to prepare to moor. Since the equipment they were going to unload was heavy as well as delicate, it was important to make the craft secure. The President settled back, tapping his fingers on the arm of his seat, gnawing his lip, but saying nothing and letting the pilot work unflustered. From his hiding place in the transverse bulkheads at the rear of the cabin, Lord Roke watched. Several times during the flight his little shadowy form had passed along behind the metal mesh, clearly visible to anyone who might have looked, if only they had turned their heads. But in order to hear what was happening, he had to come to a place where they could see him. The risk was unavoidable. He edged forward, listening hard through the roar of the engines, the thunder of the hail and sleet, the high-pitched singing of the wind in the wires, and the clatter of booted feet on metal walkways. The flight engineer called some figures to the pilot, who confirmed them, and Lord Roke sank back into the shadows, holding tight to the struts and beams as the airship plunged and tilted. Finally, sensing from the movement that the craft was nearly anchored, he made his way back through the skin of the cabin to the seats on the starboard side. There were men passing through in both directions, crew members, technicians, priests. Many of their demons were dogs, brimming with curiosity. On the other side of the aisle, Mrs. Coulter sat awake and silent, her golden demon watching everything from her lap and exuding malice. Lord Roke waited for the chance and then darted across to Mrs. Coulter's seat and was up in the shadow of her shoulder in a moment.
What are they doing?
Landing. We're near the generating station.
Are you going to stay with me or work on your own?
I'll stay with you. I'll have to hide under your coat.
She was wearing a heavy sheepskin coat, uncomfortably hot in the heated cabin, but with her hands manacled, she couldn't take it off.
Go on, now,
she said, looking around, and he darted inside the breast, finding a fur-lined pocket where he could sit securely. The golden monkey tucked Mrs. Coulter's silk collar inside solicitously, for all the world like a fastidious couturier attending to his favourite model, while all the time making sure that Lord Roke was completely hidden in the folds of the coat. He was just in time. Not a minute later, a soldier, armed with a rifle, came to order Mrs. Coulter out of the airship.
Must I have these handcuffs on?
I haven't been told to remove them. On your feet, please.
But it's hard to move if I can't hold on to things. I'm stiff. I've been sitting here for the best part of a day without moving. And you know I haven't got any weapons because you searched me. Go and ask the President if it's really necessary to manacle me. Am I going to try and run away in this wilderness?
Lord Roke was impervious to her charm, but interested in its effect on others. The guard was a young man. They should have sent a grizzled old warrior.
Well, I'm sure you won't, ma'am, but I can't do what I ain't been ordered to do. You see that, I'm sure. Please, stand up, ma'am, and if you stumble, I'll catch hold of your arm.
She stood up, and Lord Roke felt her move clumsily forward. She was the most graceful human the Gallivespian had ever seen. This clumsiness was feigned. As they reached the head of the gangway, Lord Roke felt her stumble and cry out in alarm, and felt the jar as the guard's arm caught her. He heard the change in the sounds around them, too. The howl of the wind, the engines turning over steadily to generate power for the lights, voices from somewhere nearby giving orders. They moved down the gangway, Mrs. Coulter leaning heavily on the guard. She was speaking softly, and Lord Roke could just make out his reply.
The sergeant, ma'am, over there by the large crate, he's got the keys. But I daren't ask him, ma'am, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, thank you anyway.
Lord Roke heard booted feet moving away over rock, and then she whispered.
You heard about the keys.
Tell me where the sergeant is. I need to know where and how far.
About 10 of my paces away, to the right. A big man. I can see the keys in a bunch at his waist.
No good, unless I know which one. Did you see them lock the manacles?
Yes, a short stubby key with black tape wound around it.
Lord Roke climbed down hand over hand in the thick fleece of her coat until he reached the hem at the level of her knees. There he clung and looked around. They had rigged a floodlight, which made the wet rocks glisten brilliantly. But as he looked down, casting around for shadows, he saw the glare begin to swing sideways in a gust of wind. He heard a shout, and the light went out abruptly. He dropped to the ground at once and sprang through the dashing sleet towards the sergeant, who had lurched forwards to try and catch the falling floodlight. In the confusion, Lord Roke leapt at the big man's leg as it swung past him, seized the camouflage cotton of the trousers, heavy and sodden with rain already, and kicked a spur into the flesh just above the boot. The sergeant gave a grunting cry and fell clumsily, grasping his leg, trying to breathe, trying to call out. Lord Roke let go and sprang away from the falling body. No one had noticed. The noise of the wind and the engines and the pounding hail covered the man's cry, and in the darkness his body couldn't be seen. But there were others close by, and Lord Roke had to work quickly. He leapt to the fallen man's side, where the bunch of keys lay in a pool of icy water, and hauled aside the great shafts of steel, as big around as his arm and half as long as he was, till he found the one with the black tape. And then there was the clasp of the keyring to wrestle with, and the perpetual risk of the hail, which for a Gallivespian was deadly, blocks of ice as big as his two fists. And then a voice above him said,
"You all right, Sergeant?"
The soldier's demon was growling and nuzzling at the sergeant's, who had fallen into a semi-stupor. Lord Roke couldn't wait. A spring and a kick, and the other man fell beside the sergeant. Hauling, wrestling, heaving, Lord Roke finally snapped open the keyring, and then he had to lift six other keys out of the way before the black-taped one was free. Any second now they'd get the light back on, but even in the half-dark they could hardly miss two men lying unconscious. And as he hoisted the key out, a shout went up. He hauled up the massive shaft with all the strength he had, tugging, heaving, lifting, crawling, dragging, and hid beside a small boulder just as pounding feet arrived and voices called for light.
Shot?
Didn't hear a thing.
Are they breathing?
Then the floodlight, secure again, snapped on once more. Lord Roke was caught in the open, as clear as a fox in the headlights of a car. He stood stock still, his eyes moving left and right, and once he was sure that everyone's attention was on the two men who had fallen so mysteriously, he hauled the key to his shoulder and ran around the puddles and the boulders until he reached Mrs. Coulter. A second later, she had unlocked the handcuffs and lowered them silently to the ground. Lord Roke leapt for the hem of her coat and ran up to her shoulder.
"Where's the bomb?"
he said, close to her ear.
"They've just begun to unload it. It's the big crate on the ground over there. I can't do anything till they take it out. And even then..."
"All right, run. Hide yourself. I'll stay here and watch. Run!"
He leapt down to her sleeve and sprang away. Without a sound, she moved away from the light, slowly at first so as not to catch the eye of the guard, and then she crouched and ran into the rain-lashed darkness further up the slope, the golden monkey darting ahead to see the way. Behind her she heard the continuing roar of the engines, the confused shouts, the powerful voice of the president trying to impose some order on the scene. She remembered the long, horrible pain and hallucination that she'd suffered at the spur of the Chevalier Tialis, and didn't envy the two men there waking up. But soon she was higher up, clambering over the wet rocks, and all she could see behind her was the wavering glow of the floodlight reflected back from the great curved belly of the Zeppelin. And presently that went out again, and all she could hear was the engine roar straining vainly against the wind and the thunder of the cataract below. The engineers from the Hydro and Barrack station were struggling over the edge of the gorge to bring a power cable to the bomb. The problem for Mrs. Coulter was not how to get out of this situation alive. That was a secondary matter. The problem was how to get Lyra's hair out of the bomb before they set it off. Lord Roke had burned the hair from the envelope after her arrest, letting the wind take the ashes away into the night sky, and then he'd found his way to the laboratory and watched as they placed the rest of the little dark golden curl in the resonating chamber in preparation. He knew exactly where it was and how to open the chamber, but the brilliant light and the glittering surfaces in the laboratory, not to mention the constant coming and going of technicians, made it impossible for him to do anything about it there. So they'd have to remove the lock of hair after the bomb was set up. And that was going to be even harder because of what the president intended to do with Mrs. Coulter. The energy of the bomb came from cutting the link between human and demon, and that meant the hideous process of intercision, the cages of mesh, the silver guillotine. He was going to sever the lifelong connection between her and the golden monkey and use the power released by that to destroy her daughter. She and Lyra would perish by the means she herself had invented. It was neat, at least, she thought. Her only hope was Lord Roke, but in their whispered exchanges in the Zeppelin, he'd explained about the power of his poison spurs. He couldn't go on using them continually because with each sting the venom weakened. It took a day for the full potency to build up again. Before long his main weapon would lose its force, and then they'd only have their wits. She found an overhanging rock next to the roots of a spruce tree that clung to the side of the gorge, and settled herself beneath it to look around. Behind her and above, over the lip of the ravine and in the full force of the wind, stood the generating station. The engineers were rigging a series of lights to help them bring the cable to the bomb. She could hear their voices not far away, shouting commands, and see the lights wavering through the trees. The cable itself, as thick as a man's arm, was being hauled from a gigantic reel on a truck at the top of the slope, and at the rate they were edging their way down over the rocks, they'd reach the bomb in 5 minutes or less. At the Zeppelin, Father MacPhail had rallied the soldiers. Several men stood guard, looking out into the sleet-filled dark with rifles at the ready, while others opened the wooden crate containing the bomb and made it ready for the cable. Mrs. Coulter could see it clearly in the wash of the floodlights, streaming with rain, an ungainly mass of machinery and wiring slightly tilted on the rocky ground. She heard a high-tension crackle and hum from the lights, whose cables swung in the wind, scattering the rain and throwing shadows up over the rocks and down again, like a grotesque skipping rope. Mrs. Coulter was horribly familiar with one part of the structure, the mesh cages, the silver blade above. They stood at one end of the apparatus. The rest of it was strange to her. She could see no principle behind the coils, the jars, the banks of insulators, the lattice of tubing. Nevertheless, somewhere in all that complexity was the little lock of hair on which everything depended. To her left, the slope fell away into the dark, and far below was a glimmer of white and a thunder of water from the cataract of Saint-Jean-les-Eaux. There came a cry. A soldier dropped his rifle and stumbled forward, falling to the ground, kicking and thrashing and groaning with pain. In response, the president looked up to the sky, put his hands to his mouth, and uttered a piercing yell. What was he doing? A moment later, Mrs. Coulter found out. Of all unlikely things, a witch flew down and landed beside the president as he shouted above the wind,
"Search nearby! There is a creature of some kind helping the woman! It's attacked several of my men already! You can see through the dark! Find it and kill it!"
"There is something coming!"
said the witch in a tone that carried clearly to Mrs. Coulter's shelter.
"I can see it in the north!"
"Never mind that! Find the creature and destroy it! It can't be far away! And look for the woman, too! Go!"
The witch sprang into the air again. Suddenly the monkey seized Mrs. Coulter's hand and pointed. There was Lord Roke, lying in the open on a patch of moss. How could they not have seen him? But something had happened, for he wasn't moving.
"Go and bring him back,"
she said, and the monkey, crouching low, darted from one rock to another, making for the little patch of green among the rocks. His golden fur was soon darkened by the rain and plastered close to his body, making him smaller and less easy to see, but all the same he was horribly conspicuous. Father MacPhail, meanwhile, had turned to the bomb again. The engineers from the generating station had brought their cable right down to it, and the technicians were busy securing the clamps and making ready the terminals. Mrs. Coulter wondered what he intended to do, now that his victim had escaped. Then the president turned to look over his shoulder, and she saw his expression. It was so fixed and intense that he looked more like a mask than a man. His lips were moving in prayer, his eyes were turned up wide open as the rain beat into them, and altogether he looked like some gloomy Spanish painting of a saint in the ecstasy of martyrdom. Mrs. Coulter felt a sudden bolt of fear, because she knew exactly what he intended. He was going to sacrifice himself. The bomb would work whether or not she was part of it. Darting from rock to rock, the golden monkey reached Lord Roke.
"My left leg is broken,"
said the Gallivespian.
"The last man stepped on me. Listen carefully."
As the monkey lifted him away from the lights, Lord Roke explained exactly where the resonating chamber was and how to open it. They were practically under the eyes of the soldiers, but step by step, from shadow to shadow, the demon crept with his little burden. Mrs. Coulter, watching and biting her lip, heard a rush of air and felt a heavy knock, not to her body, but to the tree. An arrow stuck there, quivering less than a hand's breadth from her left arm. At once she rolled away before the witch could shoot another, and tumbled down the slope towards the monkey. And then everything was happening at once, too quickly. There was a burst of gunfire and a cloud of acrid smoke billowed across the slope, though she saw no flames. The golden monkey, seeing Mrs. Coulter attacked, set Lord Roke down and sprang to her defence, just as the witch flew down, knife at the ready. Lord Roke pushed himself back against the nearest rock, and Mrs. Coulter grappled directly with the witch. They wrestled furiously among the rocks, while the golden monkey set about tearing all the needles from the witch's cloud pine branch. Meanwhile, the president was thrusting his lizard demon into the smaller of the silver mesh cages. She writhed and screamed and kicked and bit, but he struck her off his hand and slammed the door shut quickly. The technicians were making the final adjustments, checking their meters and gauges.